Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the December 13th, 2012 meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Planning Commission. Please call the roll, Ramona.
Commissioner Christensen?
Here.
Commissioner Irving?
Here.
Commissioner Murphy?
Here.
Commissioner Topping?
Here.
Chairman O'Grady?
Here. Let's all stand for the flag pledge.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, this is time for a public comment. So I'd open the floor to public comments, but this is only for items that are not on today's agenda. If you wish to speak at public comment, please fill out a speaker slip and turn it in up front. I don't see a mad rush for the front, so it looks like we have no public comment for items not on the agenda this morning, so I will close public comment. Ask Ms. Griffin for planning staff updates, if any.
Good morning. Welcome to the last meeting of 2012. I did want to let you know a little bit about next year. So your first meeting is on January 10th. It looks to be a half day. One of the first order of business that you'll have that day is to elect a new chair and vice chair. So you'll also have a new planning commissioner, we're assuming, by that time. Perhaps not. We don't have a name yet, so I can't tell you any news on that front. But our hope is that you'll be a commission of five by your first meeting. The next meeting is on the 24th of January. And it's so far only a half day also, but we've got some time for noticing and things to happen there before that date, so hopefully we'll get some more items and it'll be a full day. Other than that, don't really have anything else to report unless you have any questions for me.
Well, I don't, but perhaps anyone else on the commission might? No, I guess not. Well, thank you, Ms. Griffin, for the update.
And just a side note, we're going to have a little cake for outgoing Chairman O'Grady at 1 o'clock in the little room behind the dais for the planning commissioners and staff.
Okay, well, I will look forward to that, and thanks, staff, for arranging that little going-away party. And I'll just advise commissioners that we will be recessing for lunch at 11:45 today. So, all right. First item on the agenda is it's commission business, actually, under that category. And Mr. Buckshot, I believe, is going to give us an update on the master tax sharing agreement.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
And Buck Shy, the County Administrative Officer. I appreciate the opportunity to address all of you this morning. It's actually been on my to-do list after the start of the new year to make the rounds to all of the advisory bodies and commissions and boards to introduce myself. So you'll be the first in which I'll have the opportunity to do that. I've just very briefly, and then I'll move on to the topic at hand. I've been the CAO for about 2.5 months now, having taken over for Jim Grant when he retired. Been at the county for about 10 years, started as an analyst, served as the budget director for about 6 years, and as the assistant CAO for the last 2.5 years. And prior to that, I worked in the private sector in the automotive and technology industries, and it was a really good change. I really enjoy this line of work, and I'm really excited about this new position. I thought I would also take a moment or so to introduce a few other folks who I have here this morning. First is Greg Schulte, who is our brand new Assistant County Administrative Officer as of this will be the end of his second week tomorrow, so far so good. And then it was nice to see him come back for the second week, actually. So we were all quite relieved.
Yeah, how much trouble can you get into in 2 weeks?
Right? And then Emily Jackson from my office is here. She has helped me in working on tax exchange agreements with cities with respect to. As part of that process, cities and counties throughout the state are required to negotiate the exchange of taxes that would, in theory, be commensurate with the shift in responsibility for providing services that occurs when an annexation happens. And that is driven by Revenue and Taxation Code 99 that outlines a very specific process that cities and counties need to follow with what I would consider to be fairly rigid timelines and noticing requirements for that process. And what the practice has been here in San Luis Obispo County is for my office and for the offices of the city managers to do that negotiation. So what I'd like to do is, if Emily would hand out a summary sheet here, is walk through an overview of the actual agreement and then talk through the specific the agreement itself. While she's handing that out, I thought I would just address one other piece of background, and based upon the information I've received, I believe your commission's interest in this may have been driven by some discussion about the Eagle Ranch development that is outside of Atascadero and is being discussed as a potential annexation. And I think, you know, frankly, what's kind of happened a bit from what I've heard is that the tax exchange agreement may have been used as a bit of a diversion in order to buy the city a little more time to work on this project. You know, I've met with the city a few different times. There are a lot of challenges with the Eagle Ranch project, and they need more time to work on that from what I'm hearing. In fact, I met with the city manager a few months ago to talk through where they're at and essentially ask them what they would like from us. What is it what is your proposal for how you would like to see this play out? And I've not received anything back at this point. So the bottom line is that the ball is in the city of Atascadero's court, at least from my perspective, with how those discussions proceed going forward. So with that, let's jump into the actual agreement. As you can hear, I see on the summary sheet, you know, over the years, there have been a lot of very contentious negotiations amongst the cities and counties throughout the state, and a lot of horse trading has occurred. And so what some counties and cities have done, and we happen to be one of them, is to create a master agreement that attempts to create a very fair and equitable process for making that exchange of taxes. And, you know, something that I think has been of a bit of a misnomer that's been circulated out and about, from what I've heard anyway, is that this is a county agreement, that this is what the county requires. Well, the reality is that this was a cooperative effort amongst the seven cities and the counties back in 1996, and this agreement was adopted by a majority of the cities in addition to the Board of Supervisors. There was actually a joint meeting with the seven cities and the county at the Embassy Suites in 1996 in which this was reviewed and then ultimately adopted. As you can see here, the foundation for the study was, or for the agreement, was a study conducted by, at the time, Crawford, Multerry, and Starr, and that provided the financial analysis and background. And I would like to add that, at least from the county's perspective, and I think if you were to talk with David Church, the executive director of LAFCO, that the agreement's been used rather successfully for the last 16 years. You know, the cities would not have joined on to it if it didn't work for them, and certainly the county would not have agreed to it if it didn't work for us in terms of a fair exchange of taxes. So as a result, annexations, at least on the exchange of revenue, has gone relatively smoothly. What's happened in other counties that don't have agreements in place are that the city will move forward an entire proposal. It'll be before LAFCO, and then the counties have essentially the final leverage with respect to the negotiation of taxes, and many annexations have been what many would say unfairly held up as a result of counties trying to get as much money out of the deal as possible, and that's really not the approach that we've taken here at the county. So as you can see, the purpose is pretty straightforward, that the county should not profit from annexations, nor should the annexations result in a net fiscal loss to the county. So the idea is that it would be revenue neutral, that we're going to give up the responsibility for certain services, and in doing so, a certain amount of taxes would be transferred along with that responsibility. The second key purpose of the agreement, which I think is important, is that tax exchange practices should not undermine good land use planning by discouraging cities from pursuing logical and appropriate annexations. Obviously, annexations are an important land use tool, and we support those to the extent that we can. So let's jump down then into the specifics of the agreement, which is attached as the second page, but we can just stick with the summary sheet for now. There are different categories for how the taxes are divvied up depending upon the particular arrangement, whether it's a commercial and industrial plan for what will be built on the site, residential, there would be mixed use, and there may be some additional retail or tourist type of development built in. The city would then receive all of the sales tax and all of the transient occupancy tax in that particular example. So if you jump down to the lower portion of this top sheet, the rationale for this agreement, as you can see, is outlined here. On the left side are the numerous services that counties provide. This is not unique to our county. This is what counties are tasked with doing throughout the state. We have 22 departments, and most or all of them are listed on the left-hand side. And on the right-hand side, you can see what are fairly standard municipal-level services that cities provide. And so essentially what happens when an annexation occurs is that the police, fire, public works department, and community development pick up those responsibilities from the county. So land use transfers to and oversight transfers to the city, as does maintenance of roads and infrastructure and obvious police and fire. You know, I listed parks and recreation there because folks oftentimes still use the county parks, even if additional parks are developed. I think a good example, since I mentioned Eagle Ranch earlier, is, you know, Heilman Park in Atascadero. A lot of the users of that county park are city residents, and even if, say, Eagle Ranch were annexed and a park were developed, I would anticipate that many folks would still continue to use Heilman Park. So we don't necessarily see a transfer of responsibility and cost when that occurs. And then on the left-hand side, you can see we're still required to provide all of those other services to the residents of that newly annexed area, which, you know, I'm not going to read them all, but they include tax collection, prosecution services, elections, public health, mental health, social services, and the like. And that is essentially the underlying principle for how the overall tax exchange agreement was created. And then lastly, as you can see, what's noted there is that the agreement was adopted by a resolution by a majority of the cities as well as the county. And if there were any interest in varying from this agreement, we would obviously have to go back to the Board of Supervisors and those cities that approved this document and agreement in order to make any changes. And with that, I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Buckshy. Commissioner Irving.
Yes, sir. Thank you for...
Jim, you have the wrong light on there.
Wrong light. Thank you.
It's been a
guy, you'd think I'd know how to push buttons by now. Thank you for coming. And it was, I think, the economic element we were talking about that brought this to at least my awareness. This was created in 96 using all seven cities, but not signed by all, correct? Then. And also, so what? How does it operate with regard to the three cities that did not approve the agreement?
Yeah, essentially, we've had a handshake agreement to still use the agreement, and the rationale being is that if it worked for the four cities, it in theory should work for the other three cities. And so the county's negotiating position has been we're going to, utilize this agreement. And to date, the three cities that didn't sign have agreed to do so. What seems to happen is every few years an annexation may come up with a city that hasn't done an annexation for a while, and some questions come up about, this proposal and how it works. And I think we're seeing another cycle of that at this point in time.
Okay, thank you. This was created in 96. Has there been no revisions since then?
That's correct. There
and,
are not.
And, but given the, I mean, do you have it, is it in the works to consider that, given the adoption of strategic growth principles and really focusing more on on development within cities? Is there the thought of revisiting this topic, or do you think it's over and done?
No, I think it's certainly an option. You know, the way I view it is if the seven cities have an interest in working together and with the county to revisit the agreement, I'd be open to doing that. It's certainly not on the top of my priority list to push an update to this agreement because it's worked. However, if there were interest amongst the seven cities to do so, I would entertain that.
Well, I guess what I'm getting at kind of goes back to those that signed on, and we could use Atascadero as a specific example. Since they haven't signed on to it, are you free, is the county free to modify it dramatically, or are you if Atascadero wants to change that percentage around because most of Eagle Ranch is residential, not commercial or whatever.
Well, what I would like to see on any particular example, if we were to entertain any discussion along those lines, is a very detailed financial analysis for why this agreement wouldn't work. As I've mentioned, we've used this for 16 years very successfully for some very complicated annexations over the year, one of which was the Delidio project, which ultimately didn't go through, obviously, because of the referendum. But nonetheless, from a tax exchange agreement perspective with this, I would be interested in seeing those details as to why not, and then we could have some discussion from there.
And LAFCO would presumably as well. Do they take that into consideration, the way the taxes are shared and their approvals? Or?
Actually, their approach has been, if the city and counties agree to it, they've not dabbled in the financial end of it at that point.
Okay. Commissioners, any other questions? Well, thank you, Mr. Buckshot.
Okay, well, thank you.
Well, this takes us to the consent agenda. Does any member of the public or the commission wish to pull any item that's on the consent agenda this morning? Hearing none, then I would ask Ramona to call the roll to approve.
We have to make a motion.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we better make those motions first. It has been a couple of months.
Move to approve the minutes.
Thank you very much.
Of November 8th.
Second, please.
Second.
Now we need the roll call.
Commissioner Irving?
Yes.
Commissioner Murphy?
Yes.
Commissioner Christensen?
Yes.
Commissioner Topping?
Yes.
Chairman O'Grady?
Yes. Motion passes 5-0. This takes us to hearing item number one. Ramona, please introduce this item.
Hearing to consider a request by Irish Hills Plaza East LLC and Verizon Wireless for a conditional use permit. County file number DRC 2011-00026. Supervisorial District 3, Stephanie Hughes, Project Manager.
Good morning. Before we begin the staff presentation, is there any ex parte to report, my commissioners? Okay. Good morning.
Good morning, Chairperson, members of the Commission. Stephanie Fuse, County Planning. This project is a conditional use permit for a new unmanned wireless communications facility. It consists of 9 panel antennas. They will be contained within a 50-foot-tall faux water tank. And the proposal will also include some mechanical equipment that will be located within a approximately 1,000-square-foot lease area. The project is located on Los Osos Valley Road, and it's adjacent to the Costco Home Depot's shopping center. The Home Depot's here, Costco's here. Los Osos Valley Road is here. The project will be about here on the site. The project is located in the agriculture land use category. Excuse me, the city's in gray, and there's a little commercial retail, some rural lands on the upper portions of the site. And here's an aerial view of the city, of the site, excuse me. There's an existing barn, and this is another barn, and then the tower will be located approximately here on the site. And this is just an enlarged aerial that shows a little bit better where it will be located. And it is adjacent to the city of San Luis Obispo, but approximately 80 feet. The tower will be located approximately 80 feet from the property line. And this is a site plan. It just shows the lease area and the location of the tower within the lease area. And these are some elevations of the site. The elevations show the antennas, the Verizon antennas, will be located at the top of the tower, and then future co-locations will be located below that within the tower. And then more elevations. So the primary issues with this were visibility, since the project will be visible, and our concern was limiting the noticeability of the project. Since it will be visible, what can we do to make it less noticeable? And so we decided with colors and treatments of the tank that that would help the noticeability of the project. So the recommendation is to approve the conditional use permit based on some revised findings, and I can read those into the record in a second, and conditions listed in Exhibit B, and that the commission adopt the negative declaration prepared for the project. And so the findings would be on page 1-9, and the findings that we were recommending changes to were finding A. And the change would be, I'll just read the whole thing, the environmental coordinator, after completion of the initial study, we would strike the word finds and replace it with found, comma, and the planning commission agrees, comma, that there is no substantial evidence that the project may have a significant effect on the environment, and the preparation of an environmental impact report is not necessary. Instead put, is not a use that is inherently compatible with the character of the surrounding lands and uses, comma, the project has been designed to blend with the existing ranch structures on the project site. And then we're going to add at the end, the height and location of the tower and equipment have been placed at a location on the site that allows for future co-location, reducing or eliminating the need for new facilities. In addition, mitigation measures proposed for colors and materials will further reduce potential incompatibilities with surrounding uses.
Well, I like that because it seems to me that this change is less generic and actually responds to particular conditions on the project, and really is why at least this commissioner.
That was based on communication with another commissioner.
So. Yes, right. So, okay. Did you have anything else that you wanted to add to your staff?
Well, actually, I did, based on other communication. On page 1-15, condition 26.
Okay.
We would take out if technically feasible.
Okay.
Since we are recommending the tower to remain at 50 feet, we want them to co-locate.
So we're concluding it is technically feasible at this
right.
time. Okay. Thank you. Commissioner Irving, your light's on.
Thank you. Stephanie, one question is this a 50-foot tower plus a 20-foot tank, or is it 50-foot from ground to top of tank? Because I see wording on 1-7 that indicates that there was a 20-foot tank on top of the tower. So what's the overall
height? Overall height is 50 feet.
Top of tank to ground.
Right. The tank itself is 20 feet.
20 feet.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see where I can find that. Anyway, that was my one question about that.
Commissioner Toppe?
Yeah. Was there a viewshed assessment or any kind of photo simulation done to identify what this would actually look like from different perspectives?
There was. The visual study... the photo simulations were a little bit misleading, I think, though, because the photo sims did a 50-foot tower with white paint on it, and then the other simulation was a 40-foot tank that was brown. So our recommendation is for a 50-foot tank that is brown, and we didn't have a photo simulation for that.
I guess what I'm wondering is how visible is visible. I don't really see... from the material that we have in the staff report, any features on surrounding properties or some way to get a handle on what it actually would look like, other than the drawing, which is a straightforward shot from different angles, but that doesn't really give you the sense of the impact.
Right.
Is there a way you could describe that for us a little bit, or maybe the applicant can do so?
Yeah, I think the agent would probably okay. have.
And actually, it is time to invite the applicant back to the podium. So, looks like Ms. Knight. And would you fill out a speaker slip when you finish? Thank you.
Good morning, Tricia Knight, representing Verizon Wireless. Let's see, I know Commissioner Christensen had forwarded some comments and questions to Stephanie that I can go ahead, and so I'm just going to kind of clip away to that. I know some questions that were asked, okay?
Sure.
So first of all, to answer the question, there was a discrepancy. It is a 50-foot tall water tank, but it's 20 feet in diameter. That's to allow for at least two other carriers to locate on that facility. And I wanted to give you a little bit perspective. I did bring photo sims, and I will show you the sims of the project. But I wanted to give you a little bit of perspective here.
If you just put the button down on the base right there, and then don't click it off.
So this is an existing 50-foot tall water tank in Old Town Orchid. I don't know when's the last time any of you have been out there, but this has been there for almost 10 years. It contains and was built as a Sprint facility, then was Nextel, and also has Metro PCS contained. It is in what is now a completely developed new commercial center. I don't know if any of you have been there, but it appears to be an old Western town. And then an entire residential development has also popped up around this. On the other side of this parcel, they went ahead and put up a faux oil derrick, or it used to be known for its. So they've used the area as it was originally proposed. But when this was built, there was currently no development around there. It was just okay. You can flip through. There is examples of. The
can
tank.
You still speak?
Examples of the tank at various locations. Is there? You can do that as well. So just take a look at this as I'm talking. An analysis was completed. So. So a couple of questions that came up were, yes, we are in close proximity to the airport, and I did submit a no hazard to air navigation that was issued to us by the FAA showing that we are in no way conflicting with any of the air paths on the property. One thing to note is that this is a capacity site. I think we've talked about this before versus a coverage site. If you had a Verizon cell phone out there, you would probably be able to make a call. But they're getting more dropped calls because of how busy that is over there. And so this is going to help offload that capacity. There's also an existing facility on a PG&E tower closer to the highway that will also, this facility will offload that. And then we had done an alternative site analysis. A question had come up. We had looked at the Perry dealership across Los Osos Valley Road. And I want to just put up one last exhibit here. So our project site, see that, is over here. Yeah, there you go. Is over here. We had looked at going on the city jurisdiction property across at Perry, Lincoln, Ford. There's a tree line that hugs the entire parcel. And in order to propose a monopine sort of tucked up against that tree line, we would have to go quite tall in order to clear not only those trees, but to split our antennas into two elevations so that they don't protrude beyond the branches. That's sort of a standard condition for monopines in the county. So we opted for going across due to the elevation is actually higher, and it's just a little further removed from the line of sight along Los Osos Valley Road. And I think that is all I have for now. I'm here to answer any questions. And
commissioners, any questions? Commissioner Irving.
And I don't know whether this is directed to you, Ms. Knight, or to Stephanie. You sent us what did you title it? Some exhibits, capacity offload exhibits. Do you want to walk us through it, or should she?
I can.
Okay. If you could bring those up, Stephanie. I have a question about. I'd like an interpretation of what they're.
Of course.
Attempting to do here.
You can scan it out or pull it back just a little bit so it's not quite so up close here. There we go. There we go. So this shows the coverage of the site without the facility. And you can see there really isn't a coverage gap here. So you're not seeing a significant change in colors. If you can slide.
What, the green, the red, the yellow?
Sure, green means coverage. Red means, yellow means a little bit less. You're not going to get a drop call. Red means that you're probably not going to be able to hold a call in those areas.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Commissioner Topping.
Sorry. So you'll see in the areas. Now, one thing that's hard to show in a propagation map with respect to coverage versus capacity is how do you show a dropped call? So as we go down these maps, these are coverage. So you're going to see, obviously, the yellow areas that are a little bit to the north, a little more towards Laguna Lakes Golf Course that were yellow and red before are no longer, now they are green, very little yellow. So you're going to have increased coverage in those areas. And then sliding down. This is showing, we had to show what it would look like, for example, if we located in a different area. There's a monopine at Laguna Lakes Golf Course. And so if we located on that tree, you can see that there's very little green. When you start getting into the purples and reds, it doesn't propagate into the, you can't even see where our proposed facility is. And then this is... It's hard to even
sort of zen
modern art here.
Focus for a minute, you'll see an image. I promise.
I see a rabbit.
This is their bet. We're trying to find a good way to illustrate dropped.
You need
calls.
Medication,
and this is one of those. The image in the light brown and black is consistent calls. As you start to get more into those pastel and blue and purple colors, the stay ahead of the game, they need to make those estimates. So they look at demographics and real estate and everything that they see the county possibly doing within the next at least 10 years. And they're building these sites to be able to handle that capacity now so that when that does come, and if there is housing that would happen to be developed or if this commercial center is continuing to grow, they're going to already have forecasted for that. So that's how they kind of stay ahead of the game so far. Who knows if that'll change or not. But for now, that is their game plan.
Commissioner Murphy.
Is Irish Hills Plaza East LLC, are they the owners of some of the box stores there, such as Home Depot?
You know what, Mr. McDonough is here. Are you? I don't think you're associated with any of the Home Depot or any of that property, are you?
The Home Depot owns their property.
You need to come.
Yes, we can't have an
off. If she wanted to go ahead and answer a question based on what he told.
Okay, so it sounds like, no, you're not directly an owner of those properties or Home Depot. No.
Could you repeat that into the microphone, please?
Yes, I'm sorry. So Mr. McDonough did comment that he is not direct, has any relationship with the owners of that property, of Home Depot and Costco.
So they're not the lessor of any of those stores?
That is correct. We had looked at locating on those properties at one point.
Right, that was why I asked the question, because it appeared, I was just under the impression they were, but if they're not, then they're not in a position to possibly negotiate with the stores.
We did. That was the first place we started because they have some tower elements on a couple of those buildings that would have worked out well. But we did have a right of refusal, and I have a letter to that effect indicating that they don't have sublease rights to have anything locating on the roof. So there was not a lease that could be worked out there.
All right. Thank you.
My question goes to the capacity versus coverage and how that weighed into the alternative site selection, specifically the Perry Fort. As I read the staff report, what I got out of it was, well, there's an elevation difference there between the higher elevation of the proposed site versus the lower of Perry. But if coverage or if capacity is the issue, wouldn't even a lower site alleviate some of the capacity issues and be satisfactory for the purposes that you articulated?
We still have to clear those trees, and due to having to split the antennas, and what that means is instead of having our 9 antennas at one elevation on a monopine, in order to make sure that those are screened, we now split those. So we'd have six at one elevation and three at the next. In order, and then you have usually four to five feet in between those two. By the time you start stacking that up, clearing the trees, stacking your antenna, we're up there in height. And so it just, we didn't believe that it was going to be able to integrate into that lot very well.
So if it weren't for the trees, then the Perry Ford
the trees and Perry Ford trying to stay out of their way. They use almost every square inch of that lot for storage and everything else. So it was trying to find a good spot as well as designing something that was feasible.
Okay, thank you. Commissioners, any further questions? All right, thank you, Ms. Knight.
You're welcome.
All right. Staff have any comments about the applicant presentation? All right, then I'd like to open public comment on this item. If anyone would like to speak, please come forward at this time and turn in a speaker slip. So far, I do not have any speaker slips. Seeing no one approaching, I will close public comment and bring this item back to the commission for any further discussion. So, Commissioner Christensen, you are the commissioner from the district.
Yes, I am. And I'm so thrilled, as usual, all of my fellow commissioners have asked half the questions I was going to ask, and thereby saving me all kinds of work. I did only have a few questions actually to begin with, and one of them was a concern about that finding that got changed, and I do appreciate that, Stephanie, very much. I think the finding E is a lot more accurate now. And then I only had two questions, and I don't know if Ms. Knight wants to come back up to the podium. I was waiting until after public comment to ask questions, but was whether or not you have any idea of it's with regard to the city's comments that they were maybe planning some residential development nearby, and I didn't know if you had any idea whether or not the placement of the water tank would impact that, those possible plans. I know it's hard to talk about things that aren't in existence.
It is. Yet. It's really hard to do the crystal ball thing. All I can say is I was trying to speak a little bit to that, showing you the orchid. When we originally built that,
right,
it was at the rear of a oil pipeline storage yard. It was literally industrial looking. If you look at it now, there's an entire commercial center as well as residential development surrounding both of those facilities. So in that particular instance, I can speak to that. It seems to have not impeded any of that development.
Right.
Occupational at a certain distance, and one that shows at a potential two-story building, and one was at 150 feet and one was at 115 feet. The closest property line for that residential development is 80 feet. So both those levels are far below what would be of any concern and definitely in compliance. And so, and they're outside of what the closest property line is. So I feel safe in saying that it would be compliant.
So even at 80 feet away from this installation, there, and that doesn't even hit the max.
Exactly. And it drops off the further it gets.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Actually, that was kind of my question, too, Mr. Grady. I just don't have radio frequency right here in my brain. So thanks for getting technical. The only other question I had to do with proposed exterior lighting, and I should have this memorized by now, but what what proposed exterior lighting do you folks usually have on these?
It's just a small timer/switch-operated light that sits atop the equipment fencing. In this instance, we're going to do a CMU wall with wood clad on the outside. So it's going to be there, but it is on a timer so that if it was to accidentally be left on, it would go off.
Okay.
But there's no lighting. The FAA has not required us to do any lighting on the tower itself, and there's no other additional lighting.
Okay, that's really important.
Yeah.
I want to try to preserve our night sky as much as possible. All right, good. That's all I really had. I really wasn't concerned about the visuals. I think that I think where it's located and where people are really looking along there, it'll be fine with the modifications and mitigations that have been put in there.
Commissioner Topping.
Well, I just have a question for staff, and that is, have we heard anything more from the city of San Luis Obispo in the last year? I noticed this letter is dated 2011, so.
I did have some discussions with one of the planners from the city, and right now, if Ramona can get the land use category map up, this is the property that we're talking about. It's about a 7-acre piece of property. It's currently zoned retail commercial. And apparently they've had discussions with the property owner about doing some mixed use on this property. As Ms. Knight stated, the FCC RF standards are fine. So I think it may be a perception thing that, okay, there's a tower there. I think the bigger concern is going to be traffic along Los Osos Valley Road and the Costco gas station, because the throughput on that gas station is tremendous. It's huge. It's a big gas station with a lot of air quality issues. So I think those are going to be the bigger limiting factors than the tower itself.
Thank you.
Commissioner Murphy.
Yeah, my question is for staff also, if you'd like to sit down.
Okay, thank you.
I'm standing there. I did on the tower in Orchid. I've seen that. It's that whole development there is kind of a western town theme, and the tower really to me looks something like you'd see at Knott's Berry Farm. It doesn't look like a water tower you'd see necessarily in a ranch. I do like the design here. This appears to be more akin to what you'd expect to see on a farmstead and with the distances involved. I had a couple questions on the mitigation compliance coordinator. I just want to know what exactly it is. It's not a monitor, but when you say a coordinator, are we just talking about somebody designated on their staff that you know who to go to, or is that somebody that's expected to carry out specific duties overseeing the monitoring of the mitigation measures?
Erlen Singwald, planning staff. So what we've experienced over the years on these cell site projects is we have agents such as Tricia, who represent the carriers, who work with planning staff on developing all of these conditions for the project. But then after the project is approved and it goes out to bid, a contractor comes to build the project, but there is a breakdown in communication between the planning representative on the carrier's side and the contractor. So what we've developed this responsibility that we call the condition compliance monitor to close that gap and to make sure that there is a designated person who is going to work with planning staff and work with the contractor throughout the construction of the site to make sure that all of the conditions are met. And usually that's a construction manager at Verizon.
So it's a designated employee. It's not bringing in a specialist or a third party that they have to pay to perform this.
Correct. It's anyone who Verizon designates in that role.
Okay. And I had a question generally on the, because we're requiring an archaeologist to do a plan and on-site archaeologist and Native American monitor, yet the initial study indicated there were no known cultural resources on the property. So could you address that issue, and including the development of the Froom Ranch next door in regards to what was found there?
While there were no resources found.
So presumably the commission would not have seen those because a CUP would not be required.
Yes, co-locations are generally minor use permits.
Okay. All right. That's one. I think I have one other question or request. Yes, on page 1-11, approved development. 1A talks about the heart of the project, the tank and the antenna mounting and what have you. It says nothing about co-location. I would like to just have a few words in there saying arranged, or you talk about at a height of 35 feet, arranged to facilitate future co-location. And otherwise, and I do understand that the pad would have to be enlarged in the event of co-location, because any other carrier is going to require additional ground-mounted equipment, would they not? And that the existing pad presumably is not large enough to handle that.
That's true.
So the wall and that we're building, that would have to be knocked down part of it and the pad
or
expanded?
Or a new lease area negotiated, so there would be a new equipment area.
Okay.
That we would look at part of the minor use permit.
That would be a minor use permit
mm-hmm.
issue. Okay, I see where County Council has the light on.
Thank you.
This is Whitney McDonald from the County Council's office. I just wanted to clarify for the record that there was the visual impact assessment was handed around, and I would suggest that we actually enter it into the record just so it's clear in the future.
Okay.
Well, just housekeeping.
Does your statement enter it into the record then, just now?
Unless your commission wishes to not include it in the record.
No. I haven't. Does any commissioner have any objection to that? No, I didn't think so. Okay. Commissioner Irving.
Your focus on the 1-11 brought a question to mind, Stephanie or Arlen, on 1B, equipment cabinets behind a 7-foot-high CMU wall. So that's a concrete block wall, but it's clad with the same kind of fake weathered wood. Is that correct? Okay, thank you.
All right. I think commissioners, council, everyone has exhausted their questions and comments. So that being the case, I think we do need a motion or two on this one. So I would entertain a motion starting with the commissioner from the district, if she would.
Okay, I'll move that the commission adopt the mitigated neg deck in accordance with the applicable provisions of the California Environmental Quality Act, Public Resources Code, Section 21,000 et sec.
May I have a second?
And approve the conditional use permit DRC. You're just in a little hurry today, Mr.
Well,
early.
Yeah. Hey, can you blame me?
You're actually hurrying me along. Now I'm starting to get the idea.
Well, I've been listening to you.
Yeah, approve the conditional use permit DRC 2011-00026 based on the findings listed in Exhibit A as modified and the conditions listed in Exhibit B as modified.
Second. 3 seconds, actually.
Thank you. All right. Is there any discussion before we call the roll? All right. Ramona, please call the roll.
Commissioner Christensen?
Aye.
Commissioner Topping?
Yes.
Commissioner Irving?
Yes.
Commissioner Murphy?
Yes.
Chairman O'Grady?
Yes. Motion passes 5-0. Thank you to staff and to the applicant.
Okay.
We'll just pause momentarily while the room adjusts to the different change in the items, and so we'll resume momentarily.
Back from the ocean.
Sort of a large musical chairs from up here watching this unfold, you know. I think we're getting set here pretty quick. Who's going to introduce this item?
Good morning, Chairman O'Grady, Jason Giffen, Planning and Building Director. I'm here with Ellen Carroll, the County Environment
Staff. I'd just like to start off and make sure that your commission received a handout with some revised condition language and new language at this point.
No, sir.
Nope. Okay, it's coming right now.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
So we'll have a brief discussion on this. I just wanted to make sure your commission had that language.
Okay,
and
we do.
There are additional copies available for the public if anybody would like to see what's been introduced to the Planning Commission.
Looks like we have it now, Mr. Wilson.
All right. Well, I'll wait for Ms. Hedges to get back, and we'll get started. And real quickly on that handout that I just provided, under new condition of approval number 22, Cal Fire just let me know that there should be one minor change in the reference, and it's with regards to the chapters referenced in condition of approval number 22. And the one that previously read and 38 should be and 58. So I'll make that change in the document that gets presented to you as the final recommendation.
So noted.
So this is a request for a throughput increase for Phillips 66. Real quickly, I'd like to let your commission know that we do have some other parties here for your commission's questions and answers if they are needed. We have APCD in the audience. APCD was the co-lead agency for this project based upon the way it was initiated. And Aaron Arlen-Janay from the Air Pollution Control District is here if you have any questions specific to implementation of the air quality mitigation measures. She'll be the one to address those sorts of questions. We also have MRS, the EIR consultant here across the table from us. We have Luis Perez and Greg Chittick from MRS. And I believe your commission was distributed a copy of the EIR, which you see the cover on the screen, a few weeks back for your review as part of this project. So real quickly, the project site is located in the South County Coastal Planning Area, just west and south of Highway 1 or Willow Road on the Napomo Mesa, and it's highlighted in red here on the aerial photo or on the map. The land use category map is shown here on the screen. The majority of the project site is zoned industrial, meaning, and it's the portion east of the railroad, and the portion west of the railroad, which is this location right here, is the railroad track that bisects the property. This portion to the west is zoned open space and is an open area with dune habitat. And as you can see, here's the aerial photo of the site that we just described with regards to the land use category. So the industrial development and the facility is located on the industrial portion of the site, and the western portion of the site is open space. Here's just a zoomed-in view of the facility for your reference in case we need to bring it back up at any point in the future. And here is a view of the existing site plan at the project site. For purposes of you looking at this at any future time, this is on page 2-6 of the EIR if there's any questions. Or to see a better view of this graphic, you can always turn to that location. So here I'll go into the project description just real briefly. As I mentioned, it is a request for a development plan and a coastal development permit to allow the increase in the daily maximum throughput to 48,950 barrels per day. What this represents is a 10% increase over their current maximum throughput amount. And for purposes of the planning permit, it goes from 44,500 barrels per day to the 48,950. And just the way that the APCD implements their permits and the way they count it, it's a barrels per year number. And the change for the barrels per year is reflected on the screen there from 16,220,600 to 17,866,750 barrels per year. So this project, as you may have read in the staff report, is not going to physically expand the footprint of the facility. What the request is to just simply allow an additional amount of oil to come into the facility and go out for processing, finish refining in the Rodeo facility in the San Francisco Bay Area. The reason why, or one of the reasons why, is The previous permit applications at the site had two conditions that acknowledged the need for a future application if any throughput increase would occur, and those are general condition 1 and general condition 3 of the 89 staff report or the 89 approval, and it's on page, those condition, the language is on page 2-9 of the staff report. Additional measures associated with the proposed project are in the following categories: air quality, noise, water resources, public safety and hazardous materials, public services, and transportation and circulation. We have had a couple comments and questions brought up through comments from the public as well as questions about coastal access. And I just wanted to briefly provide a discussion on coastal access and how this project is addressing the coastal access requirements found in the section of the ordinance referenced on your screen. This section provides a framework for the acquisition or the dedication of the access easement, and the section itself provides a path for acquiring, being the dedication of the access easement, a follow-up step which can be the timing can be defined by this development plan application, and condition of approval number 17 actually defines that timing of when construction would need to occur. And then after construction, if construction is needed for access improvements, there's an acceptance process that is required prior to the access way actually being utilized by the public, and it's a local or nonprofit public agency that would accept the responsibility of that area. So this project would obtain the dedication of the easement, meeting the minimum requirements outlined in this ordinance section, and it would then dictate the timing of any construction improvements that would be required. The following steps would then play out pursuant to the section of the ordinance that's referenced on your screen. Since the staff report was published, staff has received a few comments regarding the project. A couple of the comments were related to fire and safety. Additionally, we received comments regarding coastal access and the proposed truck routes, and we also received various comments from the applicant in a letter to staff and your commission yesterday. Real quickly, we can have more detailed discussion on these items as your commission see fit. I'd like to hit on real quickly the comment letter from the applicant and state that staff believes a majority of the comments received in that letter are addressed by existing conditions approval and or the revised conditions that were provided to your commission this morning, less a portion of the request associated with the habitat restoration condition. Staff is not in agreement with the request that was made on condition 18, which is the habitat restoration, to not require restoration of an area that would potentially continue to be used at a future time. We are supportive of the potential to do off-site restoration for damaged habitat, but because we don't have a use for that area, staff believes should be restored in accordance with the coastal policies discussed in your staff report. So, real quickly, just letting you know again that we do have those revised conditions, and they're available for further discussion if your commission has any questions or comments on these revisions. And I'm sure the applicant will also have some discussion with your commission regarding these changes. So with that, staff is recommending that your planning commission take the following action, and it would be to certify the final EIR in accordance with the applicable provisions of the California Environmental Quality Act and Public Resources Code Section 21,000 et sec, and approve development plan coastal development permit DRC 2008-00146 based upon the findings listed in Exhibit A, the conditions in Exhibit B, including the changes that we've presented here to you today, and adoption of the CEQA findings contained in Exhibit C. And staff is available for discussion at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. If commissioners have any limited questions for staff at this time, I would entertain those. Commissioner Topping, you have your light up.
Yes, I'd like to know.
Mike. Turn on your mic.
I'd like to know just briefly the communications received. There was one that came in last week by email, which was anonymous, drawing attention to fire concerns. And then the only other one I have here is I was on the road all day yesterday, I take it this came in yesterday, the Phillips 66.
Yes, that came in yesterday afternoon, and which I just briefly spoke to here in the presentation.
So
yeah, it was about,
yeah, there was
about
another
5
one.
O'clock yesterday.
So everything,
and I ended up reading it rather
early
this morning. So
okay, so it's like three communications.
That's correct. There's
okay.
Three separate parties who submitted comments.
Okay.
On the
Commissioner Christensen.
I just had a really quick question about the new revised condition number 16 about the truck routes. And I just wanted to know why it says after the Willow Road U.S. Highway 101 interchange is completed. Hasn't it been completed?
Yes, it has.
So why not even do, why even have this is revised? Why not just get rid of that?
We could do that at your commission's.
I just didn't know if there was something I was missing.
Nope, you are correct. Okay. The interchange has been completed, and that language could be stricken.
Okay, we'll talk about that later.
Let's consider it stricken then.
All right.
Oh, okay.
Good catch. Okay, Commissioner Murphy.
You had a question regarding the coastal access. I see coastal access location maps in our staff report, but I'm not clear if that dark line around those areas, do we have something that defines where the easement is?
What we've provided in that exhibit is the approximate location of where we believe the access would most likely go. And the reason for providing that approximate location is because in order to actually provide an offer, the applicant will need to prepare a meets and bounds description of that location. So what we've done is identify the area in which that meets and bounds description of the easement will fall to give general guidance to the applicant of how to complete that requirement, because it will be a requirement of county council and the offer to dedicate to describe that physically on the ground.
And this is pedestrian access, so is there parking proposed as part of this easement?
What is being required by this action is a dedication of the access way, and what the permit has established is a future permit action that then acknowledges all the follow-up requirements associated with determining the intensity of the use based upon the surroundings and the habitat value, and parking, signage, and other access improvements that could be required for this area. So this action simply identifies the need to dedicate and establishes the time frames for doing the analysis that may require construction and certain improvements. Those improvements and construction requirements are outlined in the ordinance section, and there's a permit procedure outlined in that section to allow that analysis to occur at a later time.
Did you have anything else, Commissioner Murphy?
I guess so. Is the easement, though, is that a condition that easement be dedicated as part of this project?
That's correct. But this project, the use permit that you are looking at here today, does not require the physical construction. It does require the applicant to come back within a 10-year time frame to go through the process described in the ordinance section to evaluate how intense the access should be and whether the minimum standard should be met or if something additional beyond the minimum 10-foot would be required, and so on and so forth, if additional protection measures would be required for keeping people on the path, those sorts of things.
So while we're on this subject, what's the reason for the 10 years and not 5, and why is only the easement or dedication required now and not the work? What's the theory behind that?
Well, starting with the timing, some research was done on some other projects in the vicinity, and specifically the one that I looked at was the Guadalupe oil field cleanup project that has occurred previously in the vicinity. And specific to that project, there was also some access requirements. And that project actually provided a much greater time frame for the applicant to complete the activities. Staff believe that it was appropriate to reduce that time frame that we saw in the other permit, and we believe that 10 years was adequate time to go through the analysis of the siting study and any other requirements for providing and constructing that access. There is some additional analysis that would be required because this is a condition of approval of the project. It was not a project proponent proposal. It is conditioned based upon the ordinance requiring coastal access, and the provisions of the ordinance acknowledge that could occur.
Okay. Commissioner Topping.
Yeah, just one other question, and I wasn't sure that I saw it in the staff report, and that was the distribution of the new 10% output by pipe, truck, or rail item, but and I gathered that this is a wholly different character.
Yeah, it's not a significant impact, is that right? And it doesn't even require mitigation.
So it's minor.
Is that right?
That's correct.
And we haven't heard anything from anybody like Santa Maria or anything.
We did receive a comment letter on the draft EIR from the city of Guadalupe and I believe the city of Santa Maria, potentially. Caltrans and city of Guadalupe. We have responded to those comments as part of the response to the comments in the EIR and addressed their concern.
Okay. Commissioner Irving.
Thank you. Jumping back to the coastal access, do you have an exhibit that shows existing coastal access points in the vicinity of the in the vicinity of the project, north or south? Corollary or with that, you refer to there is a requirement under the coastal land use ordinance that any development project requires coastal access? Or is there any kind of a nexus between what already exists and a new access point?
The ordinance section that requires the coastal access establishes what type of project shall be subject to that ordinance or the coastal access requirement, and it provides some exemptions to providing coastal access. Staff has evaluated that section and believes that based upon the requirements and the exemptions that it does fall into a required project and it does not meet any of the exemptions that would not require coastal access.
So the two red stars are existing public access points.
That's correct. The red star at the top of the image there is the access point at the off-road vehicle entrance at Pier Avenue in Oceano, and the red star on the bottom of the photo is the point at where the access would be taken from the Oso Flaco Lake trail, and those distances are approximately 5 miles between one another.
Is not that entire distance between those red stars, is that vehicle access?
No.
Where do you know where the division is there? Between.
I don't know the exact distance, but it's approximately the location of where the wastewater outfall line comes from the Santa Maria facility that we're looking at here to the coast is approximately where vehicle access stops, and the maintenance road that they use to maintain that pipe is what we're looking to utilize as access.
That'll do for now. I'd probably want more discussion on this later.
Certainly. I think this is a good time to take our morning break, so I declare this hearing in recess until 10:35 a.m. All right. We might start a few seconds early here, but it looks like everybody's back, so declare this hearing back in session. Where we left off was just at the conclusion of the staff presentation, so it's time for the applicant presentation. I would invite the applicant to come up and talk to us if they would so desire.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and Commissioners. My name is Kristen Kopp. I'm the Health, Safety, and Environment Superintendent at the Phillips 66 Santa Maria Refinery.
Good morning.
Good morning. The refinery's been there operating for over 50 years on the Nipomo Mesa. And in case you're not familiar with our operation, the reason it's called the Santa Maria Refinery, even though it's in San Luis Obispo County, is because our heritage is to run Santa Maria Valley crude. Currently, we get crude from all over. I just want to introduce, I'm joined today by our site manager, Jerry Stumbo, my colleagues, Marty Halber and Ed Brenninger, who work very closely with the Air District, who was the co-lead on this project, and Gene St. Martin with the legal firm Gene St. Martin and Walcott. There's about 250 people working at the refinery, and we're all dedicated to operating the facility safely. Last year was an especially gratifying year for us because we won the Distinguished Safety Award. We were one of three refineries in the whole nation to get this award from our industry, which is the American Fuels and Petrochemical Manufacturing Association. And it just wanted to share that, how we've run the facility safely to be able to receive that award. We're really happy to be before you today to bring this project to hopefully an approval. We've worked on it for several years with the county and the Air District as co-leads. We want to thank the Building and Planning Director, Jason Giffen, and especially the lead planner, Murray Wilson, for all the work they've invested into this. Mr. Wilson's staff report covered the detail today. So the permit, the application process, is to have the ability to run that much crude through the plant. That doesn't mean we're going to run that maximum every day. Just as today, our maximum is 44,500 barrels a day, and we sometimes will run, depending on maintenance activities, it could be shut down completely, or we could be running maybe 30,000 barrels per day. And whether we're running 30,000 barrels per day or 45,000 barrels per day, our risk is the same, and we address it in the same manner we do today as we will in the future if we get this permit increase. The review process has been long and thorough, gave opportunity for the community to put their comments in, and hopefully today you'll be able to approve the application. There was one question concerning the coastal access, and Jean St. Martin would like to address those concerns. If you don't have any other questions for me, or I'll take questions later also.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Jean St. Martin. I'm an attorney at St. Martin and Waylett. I've been advising First ConocoPhillips, now Phillips 66, on this project since they submitted it. The coastal access requirement is something that came up very, very recently in the process. It was not something that was part of the original project proposal. I share Commissioner Irving's concern or comment about whether there's nexus to require it. There is no, while there's a change in intensity, there's no change in, again, no physical change on the property, no physical change in how it's being used that would impact access in any way. That said, the applicant is willing to, as the condition is phrased, comply with the ordinance, but it's going to, the timeline that's provided, comply with the ordinance and the condition, the way the condition is drafted, it gives us some time to figure out how you comply with it. There are, for example, I'm not sure we don't fit into an exception, and as we look at the access route and actually constructing it, I have some safety concerns with it. One, it's an industrial facility. It's a refinery, and I think having public access in a refinery facility is kind of counterintuitive. One of the exceptions to requiring the access is if it's contrary to public safety. So I think the details of how you would address that would have to come in the how do you actually implement the access and the location of it. There's a railroad crossing, and it's because of the way the railroad right-of-way goes through the property. I mean, that's something that we don't control currently. It's my understanding if the current property owners, if they want to cross the railroad, they have to call the railroad and coordinate the time and all of that. So those are all things that I think would take us a while to work through, whether, agreement with the railroad or exactly the scope and location of the access. But I think the timing on the condition, compliance with the condition, is what allows us to agree with it and work through it. And I think that the fact that if we do construct anything, it requires a minor use permit. So at a minimum, that's the opportunity to make sure we do it and we do it right, is that we do have to get that subsequent approval for the actual building of the road. Any questions on that?
No, your client is in agreement with providing that, and that time frame is satisfactory and all of that.
I just think...
No argument, in other words. No.
I picked up on everybody's got a lot of questions. I think we have a lot of questions, too, on how specifically it gets implemented, but we're not... I think there's time and opportunity by virtue of the fact that you do have to get another permit to actually build it. Sure. And if they do anything else in the meantime, I think it's a two-pronged time limit. It's the 10 years, or if they come back for any other permits in the meantime, there's an opportunity to pick it up, but it allows us the time to put together that information and actually, you know, provide a crossing or, you know, change location or whatever and have input from state parks and all that kind of stuff. Because, again, as Murray was saying, we don't actually touch the shoreline. We're bringing people from the road to... what is a state park property at a location where there's not currently any entrance into the state park. So there's a number of things, I think, that would have to be worked out before you could actually build that access.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. St. Martin. Anyone else from the applicant wish to speak?
I do need to address one more issue. We do have an issue with Condition 23.
The revised conditions of approval number 18 on habitat restoration, does that satisfy the questions that you raised in your letter of yesterday?
We would prefer to for that area to remain in industrial use. As it's written, we would have to provide a habitat cleanup and restoration for an area that currently has coke storage. We understand that any new coke being produced should not be put out there, and we're in agreement with that, but to have to go in and change where the coke storage is now is...
What other uses would fall under your description of industrial purposes? What other...
What's currently used for coke storage.
Right, but is there something else beyond coke storage which you cannot... you can't have new coke storage there, but what is there another use that you could put that area to?
Well, currently, to move the coke around, we have trucks going in and out of that area. And we can work on reducing that footprint. We don't mind that. But currently, there is coke out there that is still viable as a product. Mm-hmm. It's mixed in with sand. It's called distress coke. So, and as the market becomes available, we can move that out of the facility.
Thank you. I just have one question. What is the estimated remaining useful life of the facility?
We continue to do maintenance and bring the facility up to current standards. We're hoping to be there another 100 years.
So at least it's more than 10 years, correct?
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Is that it for the applicant presentation?
Oh, I guess not. Sorry, it's Jean St. Martin again. I wanted to clarify my comment on the coastal access, which is just if in the process of looking at how the access is implemented, if there was a safety, if it was determined that there was a safety issue, and again, I'm kind of fixed on the railroad part of it, frankly, Yeah, I guess my prior history of it taking a long time and them not always being really cooperative with efforts, that if there was a safety issue, that we would still, the condition would still be met, but it could be met by us ultimately meeting an exception, which would be that it's inconsistent with public safety. The railroad issue, I mean, there's obviously like the site safety issue, but I think that railroad crossing is the one that pops out to me that I don't, because that involves a third party and our ability to really come up with a satisfactory solution to that. I just want, that would be the circumstance probably where it wouldn't, you know, does it actually get built? That could we would still be in compliance with the ordinance, but it would then be under an exception because we fit under the exception.
I think the commission understands your point. We'll be speaking with staff about that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Speaking of staff, do you have any comments on the applicant's presentation?
Public comment?
Pardon me?
Can we do public comment first?
I guess we can.
Yeah.
I knew the last day would be like this somehow. Okay. All right, let us then proceed with public comment. I do have two speaker slips, okay? So if anyone other than Mike Brown and Ron Espinoza would like to speak, please forward your speaker slips up to the front of the room and be prepared to speak. Okay, the first speaker is Mike Brown. I think you know the rules for presentation, so I won't repeat those at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mike Brown, Government Affairs Director of COLAB of San Luis Obispo County and Santa Barbara County. Santa Barbara County COLAB has about 1,500 member businesses, farms, ranches, and individuals, and San Luis County COLAB is growing. We have hundreds of members and a growing cadre of affiliate community organizing groups out there, and we wholeheartedly support this project and recommend approval. This is a great day in this economy for a major international company with a facility here and wants to strengthen its throughput and solidify its market share and survive is a great thing. This company employs a great many people in terrific jobs. It's a significant property taxpayer, and it purchases many goods and services here.
Next and probably last speaker, since I have no more speaker slips, is Ron Espinoza.
I'm not part of the wedding here. I wasn't sure which side to sit on.
you could take your choice.
All right. My name is Ron Espinoza. I'm with United Steelworkers of America. I represent the employees at both the Rodeo Refinery and the Santa Maria Refinery. And have worked closely with Phillips 66 and when it was ConocoPhillips when we were dealing with issues over the AB 32 and leakage of product from people being able to bring product out of state and having a fair and equitable playground for the people to – one company is advantaged over the other. So with that being said – I'm not here to stop your agreeing to the permitting of this process, but I am here to do a little complaining about it. I don't know if any of you have seen the New Times article. I have a copy for all of you so that you – I don't know who I give it to, but okay.
So that you can read it, I'd like you to consider it.
Thank you.
And the comment about the alkalods that Phillips 66 received for their health and safety last year is right on. They did it's a great award. All companies treasure it when they get it. Unfortunately, there if you look in your EIR report in section 4.4.4.5, it talks about the proposed throughput increase at the Santa Maria facility would not increase fire risk and firefighting requirements. The applicant proposes to utilize the existing fire protection system at the Santa Maria facility to provide a level of protection for the proposed project. The increased throughput would not produce additional impacts on area firefighting capabilities since the resources required to address emergencies at this Santa Maria facility under the proposed project would be the same as under the current operations. Impacts would therefore be less than significant. What is different about says it will remain the same. One of the things that occurred from the award that Phillips 66 received, they had five health and safety specialists in that location. They also work with Consolidated in rescue, EMT responses, and incident command at the refinery. In the interim, last year, they decided to become represented and ran an election. We have been trying to negotiate them being put into that contract for a year. They have implemented, we've said we're not at impasse, but they have eliminated those five specialists down to two. Now, I kind of have an issue. You're going to increase throughput by 10%, but you're going to take away the expertise by 60%. It doesn't mean they don't have the capability of still responding and those types of things, but I think it's an issue. I think we need to resolve that issue before the permitting is allowed. We are trying to put another proposal on the table that will allow 24-hour coverage, but the company has refused to come back to the table. So I'm here to let the commission understand this and consider it as one of the issues, because what is said here has changed. It is not the same. So, again, I've done this before. I've done it up in Northern California, stood up and spoke against projects, and have come back once we've managed to mitigate the issues to speak in favor of them. And I do want to see Phillips 66 and the comments from the gentleman that just spoke before, Mr. Brown, that, you know, good jobs. People want to have those jobs. You want them to stay here. We want the same thing, but we also want it to be safe and not diminished in any way, shape, or form.
Thank you very much, Mr. Espinosa. Our commission rules allow the applicant a brief period of time to respond to any public comment if they choose to do so. So
good morning. I'm Jerry Stumbo.
Good morning.
The site manager of the Santa Maria refinery. I appreciate you letting me have the opportunity to respond. Phillips 66 core values are safety, commitment, and honor, safety being first. And we take that heart, every one of our 200, 250 employees and contractors at the site. That has not changed. That has not changed last year. That has not changed today, and it will not change tomorrow. We have reorganized some items, at some safety-related issues at the refinery, but those we have not let go anybody. Our staffing has stayed the same. We are merely redistributing safety activities. Therefore, we feel that
instructed. There are some mitigation measures that require replacement of some of the existing facilities with best available control technology for air pollution measures. At this point, we don't know exactly what those will be. They need to go through the process of determining how to most efficiently and effectively reduce those measures. And they will likely require a construction permit of some sort by the Department of Building. But at this point, we don't know exactly what those are or if they would require a permit. So I just wanted to clarify that while there is no additional ground disturbance or no new facility development, there may be some construction permits required as a part of the improvements through the mitigation measures. It sounds like everybody's basically on the same page with coastal access. What I'll follow up with is that staff acknowledges the challenges about complying with the coastal access section of the ordinance, and that was why we chose to provide some additional timing and not require them to implement it now, because it would become very problematic to accomplish that in a reasonable time frame and allow them to implement their project.
So issues with the railroad and public safety can be worked out as part of the process. Is that what I hear everybody saying?
Yes, we understand there are both potential environmental concerns associated with the alignment and safety issues associated with the railroad and the facility itself. Mm-hmm. The alignment that was identified in that exhibit was chosen to keep all people on that path outside of the security fencing. That was the first kind of swash effort of the department to identify the location, and through that analysis we'll determine if in fact we do have safety concerns and whether or not it's appropriate at that time.
Yeah, so you've narrowed it down somewhat.
Correct.
On this, I have three commissioner lights on. If they are on this particular topic, then Commissioner Irving.
Thank you. Murray, could you bring up the exhibit on Map 2 on 2-45 of the staff report and explain some things to me about that, as long as we're talking. So could you walk me through what the big loop up at the top, property boundary of the facility, and then this looping road that goes down, I guess to it's going down to the coast, but it stops at state parks. Is that correct?
That's correct. So the ordinance requirement acknowledges the need to provide access from the nearest public location or road, which is this portion in the northeastern portion of the picture, the corner at Willow Road where it goes, it turns from north-south direction to east and west. That's the entrance to the facility outside of their security gates. So what we've tried to identify is, in order to get the public from the location where they are authorized to be to a point at the property line, which is this location here along that access road, which is the edge of their property and anything associated with this entitlement, provide that access point. And in general, where that follows is the entrance road down towards the employee and guest parking area on the site outside of the security fencing, across the existing railroad crossing, which staff and the applicant acknowledge there are some concerns that need to be addressed there, and then following in general the location of the existing road to minimize any additional disturbance within that open space area.
Do you have an idea of or sense of how what that distance is from the upper corner to where we get down to the state park?
Well, if you'd like to bear with me, I can pull off a measurement.
Well, I you want to show your expertise? Absolutely. I'm curious. He's good.
Boy, it's going to be quick and raw, but it's going to be close. So that's approximately 8,000 feet, or a little over, I guess, a mile and a half.
Wow. Okay. Then, as I was understanding Ms. St. Martin's comments about, if we get into this process and they're unable to come to an accord with the railroad, then that qualifies it for exception and therefore no access is required. Is that?
Well, that would be their assertion of why it met the exception, and staff right. would evaluate that as to whether they had fully went
if
to the extent that they needed to exhaust that
right,
effort. Yes.
Right. What about the issue of the safety issue from a potential user of the of this map? What I was curious, my question to you earlier about the division between the vehicle portion of the coast and the non-vehicle portion is where this emptied out. Did it empty it out into the vehicle portion or into the non-vehicle portion? And the implications of that, you had said, I think, earlier that this would only be for pedestrians, so it couldn't be developed as another vehicular access point.
It's feasible that it could. I'm based upon the resources on the site, from a staff perspective, vehicular access could be problematic. So in order to determine whether or not vehicular access was appropriate, that will also be looked at in combination with the environmental resources, the safety concerns. There may be an agreement that can be reached between the applicant and the railroad that says you can put additional people over here with some additional safety improvements, but not additional vehicles. We don't know how it will play out, and I believe, but I would ask the applicant to confirm this, where the existing maintenance road outlets into the state parks area. I'm not 100% sure that it's right at the boundary of the off-road vehicle area. I believe it may be in an off-limit area until you're further out onto state parks property, but I would ask that the applicant verify that.
Okay. Those are my questions on this topic. Thank you.
Okay. As long as we're staying on this topic, Commissioner Topping.
I just want to get this on the record. This is strictly for pedestrian access, right?
No.
So what would... Okay, so... What types of vehicles would go across there?
At this point, I cannot tell you with certainty whether vehicles are appropriate for this use, for this accessway. That is what we would determine through the subsequent minor use permit and or development plan on the project site.
So you might have off-road vehicles accessing this through this route?
I will say it's theoretically possible, but the criteria to determine the intensity of use and the siting of that road will be provided. The applicant will need to submit information to the department to say how they would or would not be in compliance with the siting criteria and the proposed intensity of that. We'll review those and probably contact the state parks because it's going to be going right into their back door. Make sure that it's consistent with everything that would need to be completed, such as providing access to a vehicle area or a non-vehicle area. That may be the limiting factor.
Okay, and how is this covered in, the EIR, the potential off-road vehicle access?
This is not a part of the proposed project.
Okay.
So this was conditioned as a requirement of the ordinance, so it's not covered in the EIR.
Okay.
Commissioner Murphy.
So our actual condition of approval we're talking about is that they comply with the ordinance.
That's correct.
But they were saying they have to comply prior to a notice to proceed, so that implies that there's got to be some agreement reached as to whether there's an exception or no exception, whether this is feasible, possibly what the site of the access is going to be prior to this permit being implemented.
Well, they need to provide an easement with a meets and bounds description in the approximate location that was shown on Exhibit 2. Or
they need to take the position that the ordinance exempts them.
I might defer to counsel on that one.
That's what I'm saying. My impression here is if we're requiring them to comply with the ordinance. Well, there's an ordinance that has exemptions in it, and they're indicating they may feel they're exempt from having to provide an access. So at this point, we're only requiring compliance, but the issue is going to have to be resolved prior to notice to proceed based on our condition here.
And I believe the way the condition is written that it requires compliance with the ordinance section, but it also specifically requires the dedication of that easement. And then it provides the time frames for evaluation for construction of improvements. So I believe, unless Ms. McDonald has a different perspective, that this permit would actually require the dedication. And if at a later time it was determined to be infeasible, then they could amend this permit condition through that future action. And that's the part that I would like counsel to verify.
Ms. McDonald.
Thank you. I do think that Murray's characterization is correct, that we would require the offeror to dedicate before they get their notice to proceed. But it could be that in an exploration of how the exact access way would be drawn, potential for construction.
This one condition.
Which condition is
it? I'm looking at 17.
17, okay.
Which is a condition of approval that addresses the coastal access.
Yes, you are correct. What I did was under the ordinance section, which, let's see, I don't have it up. Under that ordinance section, there's a procedure for acquisition, and the first step, step A, is offer the easement area. Step 2 requires construction prior to the entitlement unless you dictate the time frame. So consistent with that section, we would require it, but I would also defer here to Ms. McDonald of whether or not they could potentially show that they are exempt pursuant to that, and I'll try and get the language up so everybody can look at it right here.
And I think to jump in here, it could be that before they get their notice to proceed, they're able to come up with additional information for us that shows that an exemption would apply, and so maybe we catch it before they even provide that offer for dedication. So it kind of depends on timing, when the notice to proceed is going to be issued, and how far things have gotten with the other, the other potential parties here, and evaluation of the site. So we've got a few options.
And that's how I'm reading this. They've got to comply with this ordinance before notice proceeds. So you're going to either meet an agreement or not with them, and be, if not, I guess you'll fight it out, so to speak. But at this point, they're not necessarily agreeing that they even have to provide the access, only that they'll comply with the ordinance. And that's what the condition says, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Commissioner Topping?
Yeah, of County Council, am I missing something here? Is this...
not in there.
It's not in there. So
it's not applicable.
Yeah, okay. But what if the access provided had a stimulative effect on the use of the adjoining state property? Is that
well? Then
that would be a wholly separate issue handled separately by a different EIR and whatever regulatory function goes with the state property.
Correct. So I think whatever the final design of the access way, you know, once we get to that point and it's more definite, we would have some further discretionary review, in which case we would do our required environmental review of however it's being laid out at that point in time.
Yeah, the reason I'm asking is because the particulates coming off the state property have been at issue here locally, of course, and just wanted to make sure that this is not in any way a backdoor to that, to aggravation of that.
Commissioner Irving, did you have something else on this topic?
For Ms. McDonald, then the wording of Condition 17 right now, should it not be modified in some way to say that that allows, as you just mentioned, if they came up with some information to you that indicated that it was not possible to achieve the necessary easements or dedication or permissions from the railroad, that this condition no longer applied. I mean, in other words, to ease that process of, sounds like they, if required, COSA, condition of, if required. I'm not certain that the wording of this is clear enough that if they gave you information that said otherwise, that we can't come up with a safe access point or safe route, that it wouldn't apply. But you think it's sufficiently worded here by the wording of if required? I don't. Do you get my question here?
I do. I think it's, because it says that they shall comply with that section of our ordinance, and if it turns out under that ordinance they've complied because it's not required, I think that would cover it.
Okay. All right. I was.
Or if the county decides that this is not a good thing, that's the other way out. So.
But they still have to be, before the county could decide that, they'd have to come to you with that offer of dedication.
Well,
either the offer
or the reasons.
No, there'd be some preliminaries.
Exactly. Yeah, they're going
to. At some preliminary point, before we even got to that point,
yeah,
you guys could come to this agreement and say, yeah, you're right.
Correct.
Doesn't apply. Okay, thank you.
Look back in my history. In the early 80s, I responded to a fire myself at the refinery, a gasoline holding tank that was on fire, and I assure you the imprint of that memory is still within me. We did ask for some late conditions, and I appreciate your support on these conditions. I'm sorry that they were added so late. Both I apologize to the Phillips 66 folks and to you to have to bring them forward at this time, but I do believe they add value to the project and ensure that we're both have complying with existing conditions, and the first condition we added, 22, does that. It doesn't state that they're not doing that now. It just ensures that they continue to do that. And then the other condition, 23, is necessary because of the specialized training that's required to deal with incidents at the facility, incidents such as confined space rescue, which is much more advanced now in this current era than it was in the early 80s when I was responding out there myself. It also, we have hazardous materials team training requirements, and these are continuous. People come and go, as you know, from fire departments and from hazardous materials response teams, and we need to make sure that these people are continuing to get training along the way. So this condition will ensure that we have the resources to be able to make sure they're getting that specialized training. And therefore, we hope that you'll support those conditions.
Well, I sure have a question about this item. I think we've heard before that there needs to be a nexus between the added condition and the project. And since this project does not involve additional construction, in fact, the additional construction's already been done by prior improvements, and as I understand it, they're just will be operating the facility to the extent that these improvements allow, which allows for a 10% throughput increase. And so I guess maybe the question's for Ms. McDonald. Is this, in your opinion, an appropriate nexus to, at this point, add $25,000 training fund when the operation is essentially the same as it was, and that's just 10% more? There's no functional difference that I see, so I'm having trouble seeing that this is the nexus, necessary nexus. So maybe you could explain why there is that is one.
So I'm probably going to do one of those lawyer things, and I'll tell you what the test is and what a court would look at, and then I think you need to, your commission needs to decide whether or not you believe the facts and the evidence are there to support the nexus. So what you need to look for is whether or not there's an impact from this particular project, which, like you said, is a 10% increase in throughput, and the essentially the mitigation measure that we are requiring as a condition of approval. Even though it's not identified in the EIR, there can still be impacts from the project that don't relate to environmental impacts that could be the subject of mitigation. And so here, and I believe I've heard from Chief Lewin that there is the increase in a throughput. You know, you need to decide if there's a connection between that and an increase on fire services. And in this particular case, additional training and personnel to respond to this particular type of facility. So is there that connection between the throughput increase and the need for the additional training and personnel? And then is the amount that we're asking for proportionate to that increase?
That was part B of my question. How was the $25,000 arrived at?
If I may, Chairman, the $25,000 was arrived at by calculating the cost of sending one employee to hazardous materials specialist training a year. And that number, of course, we'd like that to be have the flexibility of using the training or buying equipment most appropriate for that year, but for whatever the specific training. But we tried to come up with what's the best methodology for determining the cost. And that was a hard number that we could come up with that would be consistent. We didn't want to make a number so vague and all over the place that the Phillips 66 couldn't manage the on how to provide the revenue. So this is revenue for the department to be able to pay for specialized training using the hazardous materials specialist level of training as the amount.
So is this an increase of $25,000 over some current amount, or is this from zero to
$25,000? This is new revenue to the county. The nexus that I wanted to make.
That be just.
Well, it can be likely, but chances are it won't be likely that we will do nothing. I mean, we are continually sending people to training. That's what.
But you could have everybody who's down there say they are gone to training over the last 6 years, and they're all it's the same guys and gals, and no one else needs training this year, and you've got all your equipment and it's brand new, and it's possible. So we're not just it's not actually a fund that sits there and gathers money. It's literally you're saying help us with our annual training needs.
We will not invoice $25,000 a year for nothing. We
right.
will invoice $25,000 for something.
Yeah, you're just giving, trying to get an idea of okay, we're not going to try to. If you just took out the $25,000 thing, it would just say the applicant shall fund specialized training and equipment, and you'd be kind of like, well, what does that mean? So you're trying to just nail down exactly what you're expecting.
Yeah.
Has the refinery already been helping you with training? I thought I heard the applicant say that.
Yeah, we do cooperative training with the facility already. Our folks, we send our fire engine folks out there. Our urban search and rescue folks have trained out there. Our hazardous material team is trained out there. We do tabletop exercise for larger incidents that occur from the command and control perspective.
Okay.
So we do ongoing training with them. That will not cease what we're trying to do. It's been made very clear to me as a department head that the county, in order, we're not going to be adding services without adding revenue. We're trying to keep the county solvent. And so this is, I can't continue to add training without coming up with revenue, and this is a means of doing
that. And has the refinery, though, they haven't really paid for equipment in the past?
I have some recollection that some many, many years ago they had bought a large diameter monitor, a device to deliver water at the facility for use there. And I'm not sure we're still storing that or if that's back at the facility. But, no, there's no
So this condition is really meant to basically quantify and find this – financial support for expected training and materials related directly to the front refinery.
Yeah, and I assure you, this is a very small amount of money. I mean, $25,000 is a lot of money, but in the scheme of training and fire department equipment, this is a very small amount of money, and we purposely did that because we feel like we need to be doing what we can to contain costs for them as well as us.
So. Yeah, okay. I just, thank you.
Commissioner Irving.
Thank you. I have two questions, Chief. The first is, would you address the comment from the public, Mr. Espinosa, is it, about the reduction in the specialized trainers or firefighters on site?
Well, I can't specifically address what's currently going on that he was referring to, but what I can assure you is that we will make sure that the refinery is in compliance with the codes and standards that are listed in Condition 22. They will have to maintain an industrial fire brigade to those standards, and they will have to make sure that their fire protection systems are in place according to those standards. So, and I do intend to meet with management at Phillips 66 to have a dialogue to make sure that they're doing that and not deviating from that. But I can't address anything to do with the current situation there. I don't have any
authority. Do you have authority to with respect to managing staff or assigning staff at this facility?
It will be based on did they comply with the standards, and how they do that is up to them.
Okay. There was a comment from the public submitted via staff back on the 7th. About removing fire and safety shift specialists who are the only true 24/7 safety specialists and replacing, giving their duties to shift supervisors and gate guards. And did you see that comment? And would you have any comment on that? You don't really have authority over anything that they do internally, do you?
I only have authority to make sure it's that they meet the standards
the code.
That are in the code.
The other question I have is...
Excuse me, perhaps on that specific issue, looking at the condition, Commissioner Irving and Chairman O'Grady, one thing, that we could offer, although I think it's already implicit in the condition, we could add a sentence that says, at the end of 22, that says, verification of this condition shall be in consultation with CAL FIRE. Just to make it explicitly clear that CAL FIRE will be reviewing the fact that we're going to meet those the requirements.
Sure. Let's add that unless there's a commissioner objection.
No, thank you, Mr. Giffen. I'd be fine with that. The other question I had was a bigger one. You mentioned on Condition 23 that this would be either training for one firefighter, and I'm...
They We backfill behind that person while they're on the training assignment, so we're paying overtime behind that person to be in fire stations or whatever their primary mission is. And the expense of the reoccurring training. So this is the cost to send somebody from without any hazardous materials training to become a specialist, and so we use that as the benchmark.
Okay, that helps me understand that. Yeah. But of the firefighters currently stationed at the two fire stations that are on either side of this, do all of them have specialized training? Do any of them have specialized training?
Okay. Well, the specialized, we have teams in this county. One is the regional hazardous materials team. I have 16 members on a 30-person regional hazardous materials team. Those people have primary jobs in fire stations and staff. When there's a hazardous materials call, they leave those jobs, they respond to the hazardous materials incident and become part of that regional team. It's a very advanced training. We don't have a full-time hazmat team. So that would be the kind of person who would be trained. They wouldn't necessarily be at the Mesa or the Napomo Fire Station. They could be in other stations as well. The Urban Search and Rescue Team, again, this is a team that that's under my authority. They're a team of approximately 30 or so people. Other agencies belong to it, and they have advanced training in things like confined rescue, rope rescue, et cetera, that are important for a refinery. The other question you asked about was the state responsibility area fee. That is, I have two hats I wear in this county. One is the CAL FIRE unit chief. That has to do with the SRA fees. That has to do with wildland firefighting and handling those. The other is the county fire chief. The county contracts with the state for fire protection. That's the county fire department. This project is I'm dealing with it as a county fire chief, not as the state. The state does not fund our responses to the refinery. It funds our responses to wildland fires in the county as well as the rest of the state. So the state responsibility area fees do not have any impact on our response to an oil refinery fire. However, of course, all of us during a fire respond to everything, to any kind of fire. I hope that clarified that.
Commissioner Topping.
Yeah, so the one employee per year training is one CAL FIRE county employee specialist training for hazmat.
Correct, sir.
And so would it help to clarify that by saying it?
No. I'm trying to leave enough room in there that if it's more important, we buy a piece of equipment.
Okay, so leave it broad.
Yeah, okay. I think so.
Okay.
Commissioner Murphy.
Yeah, I think whether it's training or equipment is fine. It does state in here it's for personnel that could be called upon to assist firefighting or emergency needs at that facility, which could include your specialist team. It also says not to exceed. So I'm assuming you would actually be doing a billing, and that billing would spell out what the money was spent on and how it met this condition in asking them to reimburse you for it.
That's correct, sir.
Then I don't know, did the applicant have a position on this condition? I can't remember.
I
didn't like the dollar amount. Okay.
Right.
The annual amount or the perpetuity of it or both? I guess it's both. Okay.
Again, I'm Jerry Stumbo. I'm the site manager at Santa Maria Refinery. We had a problem with the dollar amount and the perpetuity. As he stated, we do lots of training at our facility with CAL FIRE, and we will continue to do that. A refinery, I agree, is specialized, and we buy a lot of our own equipment, right? And we have that to bear, right? I recently just bought a $750,000 foam pumper that I don't expect the county to supply, but we have that here for our own purposes. We traditionally try to supply our own equipment for this stuff. $25,000 going on forever is quite a lot. Escalated up seems to be excessive. I don't have a problem with training. I don't have a problem with supporting CAL FIRE in that. It just seems excessive to me.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
All right, we're going to nail this down right now. First thing I want to ask from starting with the commissioner from the district about the $25,000. Do you concur that there should be a $25,000? Would you like a different number?
Well, I kind of agree with your point earlier about the nexus here. You know, when we're asked for $25,000, there ought to be some nexus to what's creating that additional.
Well, the second question, excuse me, is going to be a straw vote on the whole condition. But I just thought we'd discuss the amount first, if that made a difference to any of the commissioners.
Yeah, I think there is a slight incremental increase in fire safety. There's a few more trucks going down. So there is maybe a smaller impact there. I'd be more comfortable maybe with a $10,000.
Okay.
Fear than a $25,000.
Okay.
There's not a lot of money going off-site from this project, and maybe there shouldn't be, but we're not imposing a whole lot of other conditions that require money paid into the county coffers, so to speak, for impact.
Okay, so would you like commissioners to consider your $10,000
amount? I would like, that's what I'm...
Okay, Commissioner Topping, do you have an opinion on the $10,000?
Well, I have to back staff on this, namely the Cal Fire, as far as the rational basis for it.
All right. Commissioner Irving.
I would support Commissioner Murphy. I would support Commissioner Murphy. However, I actually feel that there's probably I don't see the nexus as strongly.
Okay. Well, tentatively, so far we have two votes for $10,000. Commissioner Christensen.
I'm probably going to back staff more likely. But I'm not going to throw myself on a sword if it's less.
I concur with the $10,000. So. We're going to now have a straw vote on condition 23 at $10,000, starting with Commissioner Murphy.
Yes.
Commissioner Topping.
No.
Commissioner Irving.
On the basis that I don't feel the nexus is there, I would say no.
Commissioner Christensen.
I don't know what I'm voting for.
Okay.
I mean, I understand.
We're voting for the recommended condition 23 with a reduced amount.
I want to have condition 23, and I want to have it with something. So 10 or 25, I don't know. I guess we're going to get to at least 10.
We're starting at
10. No one's going to vote for 25 is what I hear.
I doubt it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm good with
that. So we've got two and two at 10,000. Is that where we're at? Can I review the votes? That's a yes. That's a no.
I have to ask something. I might be interested in another number that might be seen. The question is, what is the need triggered by this project increase in the eyes of the people that have the best specialized knowledge as to what they need to be able to handle a catastrophic incident? And so maybe it is 10,000. Maybe they just asked for 25,000. So I think you might want to ask Cal Fire representative.
Well,
to see whether
I think we understand the number. This specific
your other light.
Yeah, I mean, this specific number was in a letter they wrote to an EIR. It is actually a calculation of cost of training and backfilling staff with that personnel that had gone to training. So I know where the number came from, but I don't know if they need to train a new specialist every year for the next 10 years. So, and it was a certain level of staff person in the force that they were going to train. I can't remember what level it was. It wasn't just a fireman. It was a certain level of employee, I believe.
Okay. Chief Lewin, one more shot here, and then we need to move forward.
To give this in relationship to the hazardous materials response team costs about $500,000 a year to run. This money comes from grant money, from contributions from each entity in the county. Most of it comes from the county fire department. I'm putting $150,000 a year into the hazardous materials response team. It's an insurance policy for response to facilities that have it. Obviously, a refinery is one of those target facilities. So hopefully that gives some relationship to the amount.
Right. Okay.
Perhaps, Chairman O'Grady, if I could interject, knowing this is the last somewhat substantive issue that you're wrestling with, if there's always more than one option as well. So if the commission would like to have other options that we could discuss, we anticipate we may have some discussion on this, so it may not just be related to the dollar amount and the way the condition is written now, but there's also other options that you could always consider. such as keeping the dollar amount but dealing with the period of time, for example. We could have a condition that was written in a way that it's set at $25,000, but it is then reevaluated at some point into the future. So I just wanted to throw those.
Well, sure, commissioners are open to that, but so far our staff has just presented this, and it's $25,000. So
correct.
Staff needs to present a fallback position right now, or forever hold its peace, because we're trying to make decisions on these now. So,
well, if you're ready for that, we have a condition.
Oh, anytime.
Could you put up the fallback condition?
And perhaps while Mari's putting that condition up, the other comment that I'd like to just elaborate on that Ms. McDonald mentioned about Nexus and your concerns with whether or not there is one or not.
Yeah.
I just want to maybe simplify things. So the environmental impact report looks at impacts, and then if there are impacts, provides mitigation. This is a time, I think, where the environmental review and the planning review sometimes diverge. There's also a condition, which is not necessarily explicitly linked to the EIR, but is related to, I believe it's condition D, I believe, under the development plan, which has to do with health and public safety. And so there's a requirement there that Chief Lewis has been speaking about that requires a finding to demonstrate that there, in fact, will not be an impact to health and public safety. I'm somewhat paraphrasing the concept of the finding, but that's something that I just wanted to illustrate as not always needing to be explicit in the impact and the analysis in the EIR. That would be related to the CEQA findings. There's also the major use permit findings, which I'm speaking to, and that requires that there would not be a significant health and public safety issue. So with that, maybe, Murray, you can walk through the condition.
Can I? Let's
just hold on. Mr. Wilson, please take us through what you have on the screen.
So the primary change to this condition, as you can see, it still requests the $25,000 per year funding, but then it goes on to acknowledge that there's a reevaluation phase, which would include evaluation by CAL FIRE and the planning director to determine if the funding should be modified based upon the ongoing need for protection, which they're requesting pursuant to this condition. So, as opposed to being $25,000 inflated and
forever
for the life of the project, there is a potential that after 5 years or the subsequent 5 years after that, that the needs of the county fire department may change, and it could be adjusted downward to reflect that.
Well, in the event of disagreement among reasonable parties, who has the final say as to the opinion of whether it should be modified and what amount? The county would retain that discretion.
This is our condition of approval for our entitlement, so it would come down in this situation as written to the planning director, making the final decision, but he would obviously be consulting with CAL FIRE based upon their needs and as written in consultation with the applicant.
I'm trying to facilitate an agreement here between the parties. I'd welcome the applicant to come to the podium and make a counteroffer.
Thanks for letting me speak to it. While a five-year plan is certainly probably more doable than forever, I still have some concerns with after 5 years, how do we – I feel like I probably always lose on a discussion, right?
Couldn't we insert something in there that says basically that there would be a evaluation of actual cost?
Sure, that's certainly one idea. But if you train a person and the applicant finances the training, and then there's updates to the training, it would seem to me there would be a sliding amount so that it wouldn't be $25,000 a year max. It would be 25, then maybe 15 and 10 and 5. Something to make it 25 a year, I don't...
Let's get back to the real issue.
Yeah.
We provide training to our folks in some of these same areas that they're asking to be trained for.
Yeah.
I don't mind, and we've worked with them to support them to come and train with us and to do that. I would like to continue to do that. I just have an issue with having to pay $25,000. If you said I had to provide training, ongoing training with them, and we could work that out, what that means, that's one thing. But to go on with $25,000 forever, even with I think that's excessive. 5 years is probably more doable, but I still don't know how to get out of it. So.
Okay. Well. Thank you. All right.
Well, I think it's perhaps okay. Well, if that one doesn't work, it doesn't look like that's where the majority of the commission's going. We do have one more draft condition that you could consider, if you want to put that up, Murray.
Commissioner Irving, do you have something to contribute here?
Only that I go back to the whole nexus of the thing. The EIR says there is no impact. Throughput increase at the site would not impact fire protection. I think this condition doesn't need to be in there at all. Thank you.
Well, that was not what I had hoped for, anyway. Well, I thank you for your position. Okay, this is an alternative, Mr. Giffen.
Yes, Chairman O'Grady, it's fair to say we somewhat anticipated that we would perhaps have a disagreement on these conditions. We don't know exactly which one, perhaps a magic bullet, I would think. All of them just give you some different options to consider as you try to wrestle with this issue. The difference with this condition is, let's see. I wonder if that's... Perhaps Murray, if you put up the, I don't think it was this one. I think it was a one that had to do with the timing of the condition. That's right. Now my thought process is working. So the difference with this one, it's very similar to the condition that you've already read, but it tackles I think perhaps Mr. Stumbo's concern about perpetuity. It doesn't change the dollar amount, but the difference here, instead of saying annually for the life of the project, it would be on the first payment, and then there is a period of years.
What was that other condition that I was started to read? Other that all of a sudden disappeared.
You want to scroll back to that one as well, that's fine.
That one was just that they're going to come to an agreement later on, all of them.
And that's perhaps that's the one that I outlined roughly in the beginning.
Well, I think
it would be parties would come to an agreement after this decision.
Yeah, I'd suggest, I'd ask Commissioner Irving, I wouldn't suggest me, I would just ask Commissioner Irving if a condition like this, notwithstanding his concerns about nexus, might be a reasonable compromise. To where the parties work it out.
And the timing of that would need to occur before the throughput increases in effect.
Is that
the trigger for this condition?
Yeah, prior to the notice to proceed, right.
And we're talking
about... I could support this.
We're talking about condition 23, right? Condition 22 is just a reflection of...
Yeah, and we're talking 23.
Law.
This is an option to replace the currently proposed condition 23.
Yeah.
Commissioner Murphy? You have your...
I mean, this basically throws it back to staff and the applicant to negotiate what that amount's going to be. I mean,
I think there really is a nexus. I'm kind of surprised by Commissioner Irving is saying there's no nexus. There's nexus. We already have had the applicant and the county acknowledge that the continuous ongoing training is needed for dealing with a facility of this type. There is a nexus. So all the county is now saying is, listen, you guys, let's start to get a little more real about the financial costs to the county for these types of projects. And so we're going to start talking real money instead of just continue. It's like any other projects in terms of building houses or commercial things. You know, you need increased fire, you need more roads and everything. And instead of, we don't have any refinery development fees in place because we aren't building a whole lot of them, and we're not going to build anyone now. But we're going to now acknowledge that there are direct and traceable costs to having a refinery in our county. And why not talk about what that means financially? I don't.
Well, because I refer to the EIR, which says the project increasing the throughput has no impact on public safety.
Having an impact that needs to be mitigated is not the same as having cost associated with a project.
True.
I think we have a disagreement.
But there's merit on both sides, I think. So when that occurs, I'd like to see some sort of compromise.
I think it may be less than significant impact. There's no doubt increasing the throughput by 10% does create some incremental impacts at the operation refinery. It definitely increases the amount of traffic. The department director brought up a good point. We're talking about the findings that it doesn't, I mean, regarding public safety. So I do feel there is a nexus there. I say we go 10,000 a year. It runs in perpetuity, and that's the deal. And that's what I'm proposing.
Oh, not the 19 years.
No, I don't see why we need to. We back it off from 25 to 10. I mean, we're cutting it down to a much smaller amount and just leave it at that and let it run with adjustments for inflation going forward. That's what I'm proposing. I mean, I think that's where it ought to be. They're trying to fund a hazmat response team for the whole county every year. If there's a major fire at the refinery, the fire department's not going to be the only one fighting that fire. It's going to be a major undertaking. We've seen refinery fires throughout the state, what they can be. So the potential is there, and we've got to prepare to respond to it. And I don't mind seeing them put up some money to go towards that potential response. You know, that if it doesn't happen, great, but if there's a catastrophic fire, we need to be prepared for it, and I'd like to see them contribute towards that. So
Mr. Stumbo, how about $10,000 as Commissioner Murphy is proposing? A great reduction from the 25.
Well, I agree. I don't see the nexus. Well, I do like this option 3 the best out of what we've looked at.
Okay, I'm not sure that's going to sell, so I'm just suggesting that rather than going to the $25,000 as originally written.
Can we do the 10 for a time period? I mean, again, the forever thing's kind of a long time.
Okay, there was a 19-year offer by the county here on one of the other ones, so I suggest we combine the 10 and the 19.
I'd be fine with that.
Okay. All right, so let's try this again, a straw vote on the 10 and the 19.
Well, what about what the commissioner for the district has suggested, 10 in perpetuity with the escalator?
We may get to that if it goes down, but the chair is putting a motion on a straw vote on the floor for $10,000 as suggested by the commissioner from the district for 19 years.
Salvation, I think, is here. I just
Hallelujah.
Had a very brief conversation with management from Phillips 66. What I'd like to do is withdraw this condition as they move forward on their next phase, which is the railroad spur and other additions to the plant. We'll have more time to deliberate to meet with each other and negotiate, and then come back here, and you won't be forced to deliberate under such pressure. So if you're good with that, I'm good with that.
Oh, thank you for that most constructive offer. Consider salvation. Condition 23 is history. Okay. Well, we did.
I would have been against the 10,000 anyway. I think 25,000 is nothing.
You always do. Well, the last word.
I just want to give him a little input on, you know, going forward.
So what's the timing on this next project, and does it come to the Planning Commission?
6 years will be gone.
We do not have an application for this project, so staff cannot tell you with certainty any timing.
But
the project, as described, would be required to come to the Planning Commission for a decision.
I just have to say one thing, and that is that I would have been happy to vote for the $10,000 as long as it was in perpetuity. It would be a token, essentially, in terms of the loss avoidance that's being sought. It's a very small amount of money in relation to the potential impact that a catastrophic incident could have, and I think the idea here is to have local fire people who are capable of assisting the company in the most effective and efficient way. It's a very small investment.
So
I agree.
So what's your position on the?
So I'm. It's gone.
It's, yeah, there yeah. is.
But I just wanted to make
sure. It's not necessarily gone.
The reasoning was on the record.
Well, unless we want to put it.
And staff would ask that your commission, if you agree with the suggestion by Chief Lewin to remove that condition and settle at another time with the applicant, because I have struck that, and I don't believe I heard.
I guess I made an unwarranted assumption that that would be agreeable to all commissioners. So starting with the commissioner from the district, straw vote on the
I want to leave it in.
You want to leave in 23?
That's my opinion.
Okay. Commissioner Topping.
I'm sorry.
Well, the straw vote is staff is now saying, recommending the deletion of the condition for the reasons expressed by Chief Lewin, and so does the commission agree to delete condition 23 or leave it in?
So one more dynamic for your commission's consideration. If some other resolution that's been discussed by your board about the amount and the timing were to be left in, and in the event the applicant does come back for another application on this site, this condition could be modified through that development plan process. So the result would be is that in the interim, the money, whatever the amount provided through this condition agreed upon by your commission, would be provided until such time that that condition would be revised by a separate application, similar to the coastal access requirements.
Okay. We'll have a straw vote on that one after we finish the straw vote on this one. So Commissioner Murphy wants to retain condition 23 in lieu of deleting it. Is that correct? Okay.
As written, or
yeah,
at the $10,000.
Oh, with $10,000, I would. Or 25. I thought you.
No, $10,000 a year.
$10,000
perpetuity with cost of living. Yeah, the original change that
The original.
I don't want to leave the original. I want to leave a 23 in place with the change to $10,000 a year.
Okay. Instead of deleting the condition.
Yes.
Okay. Commissioner Topping.
Sure, I'll go along with that. Even though. Okay.
So that's a yes.
That's a yes.
Leave in condition. Okay.
You're going to have support.
Leave in condition 23 with the 10,000 as opposed to the.
Well, I'm in favor of leaving it in because basically what I understand staff to be saying is that there is another project related coming through and they will probably be discussing whatever they can manage to agree on in that. Subsequent application. Is that what I'm hearing from staff?
We had a pre-application meeting on a subsequent project that has been indicated by the applicant that they will be submitting an application for. As I mentioned, we do not have an application,
right?
But we did have a
pre-application. So the likelihood is that there will probably be some discussion around this condition and possibly a one that's acceptable to everybody, more acceptable to everybody will come forward.
At this point in time, we do not have an application. Right. Is it foreseeable there will be one in the future?
Yeah.
Perhaps.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe there will be if we vote for this thing. Okay.
So
I'll say yes.
So you want to leave the condition in with the 10,000?
I'll agree with the commissioner from the district.
Commissioner Murphy.
I'd rather Commissioner Irving. 25, but, you know.
I'll agree with.
And staff has made the change, I believe, which has been requested by Commissioner Murphy. It's on your screen with the change from 25,000 to 10, just so everybody knows what we're discussing here.
Yeah, was yours a yes?
I'll move it along. Yes.
Okay, well, I vote no because I'm convinced of the goodwill with the parties and that the commission ought to use its discretion to allow that process to occur as it's going to occur on the access. So I think the commission should go away as recommended lately by Chief Lewin. Okay, so now I guess there's a part two, if I understand it correctly, to leaving this condition in with some other language that you were talking about?
It's there with you. Leave it
or is it there?
I think if the commission is going to go with Commissioner Murphy's recommendation, then
that's
the
what the straw vote that we've done so far. Yes.
Right, then the language as indicated with was
then that's okay. As
I don't think there's a part two to it.
There is no part two to it. Okay. All right. Looks like that issue is finished. Now we didn't adjourn at 11:45 and I believe we can finish this item as we keep going to 12:15. I only had one other
good item.
Do you think
all conditions of approval?
What?
Yeah. Is there other issues that you have?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, we're just finishing. We've just actually just been discussing public comment. We haven't even gotten to issues.
Okay. I understood that those were the issues that.
I haven't even talked about my two issues.
Oh, okay. Well, I stand corrected. In that case,
I'm shocked that I'm going to bring up an issue you haven't brought up to
you're going to extend this hearing. I'm shocked at that. Okay. All right. In that
case, we need to
recess for lunch and resume our hearing at 1:30.
There we go.
Welcome back, everybody. From our luncheon recess, we're going to resume this December 13, 2012 hearing of the San Luis Obispo County Planning Commission, where we left off. We just had spent quite a bit of time thoroughly ventilating a fire issue, but I think we have resolved that. And so I understand there are a few more questions or issues that commissioners would like to discuss. And so, starting with the commissioner from the district, Tim Murphy, I'd like to ask Tim if he has some other questions.
What I'd like to do, and it's, maybe this is almost part of staff presentation, but I'd like to hear from the Air Pollution Control District addressing the issue of air pollution, air quality, and particulate matter that in the draft EIR meetings and most of the communications that I read in the EIR, that was the big topic. People concerned about air pollution effect on their health, particulate matter effect on their health. And in reading through the EIR, it looks like to me there's plenty of empirical evidence that that is not a problem and it's not identified as a significant problem in the EIR, but I would like just to have them address it in general. I'm surprised there's nobody here today to speak on it based on a number of written comments we had on that very issue. So I thought at least it should be addressed during the public hearing today, just in brief, doesn't have to be long to dissertation, but just kind of comment on the what, if any, concerns or problems people should have regarding air quality as a result of this project.
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
We're doing well. How are you?
My name's Erin Arlen Janae. I'm the Planning and Outreach Division Manager for the Air District, and thank you for the opportunity to address the question. I think a lot of the public comments that we received on this project were related to other issues that are currently being addressed down in South County as it pertains to the Oceano Dunes off-highway vehicle activity that we've been working for a number of years. We have an elevated level of particulate matter in South County, and the public is extremely engaged in that issue. As it relates to the air quality associated with this project in the EIR, we did evaluate the air quality impacts, the particulate matter, as well as the ozone and greenhouse gas emissions. And as is concluded in here, there were instances on the operational side where our thresholds, CEQA thresholds, were exceeded. However, there's been mitigation identified, and with the implementation of the mitigation, it is below our thresholds on all of the pollutants.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
Just want to get that on the record.
Okay. Is there any? Do you have any other questions, Commissioner Murphy, before we move on to Commissioner Christensen?
I was looking at the issue of traffic and circulation. You know, there's an issue over regarding outgoing traffic northbound and eastbound using Willow Road versus northbound, apparently going up Highway 1. And one of the concerns brought up by the applicant was that they had what they called a gentleman's agreement with the Black Lake, I assume residents, that they would divert some of the truck traffic up Highway 1 if they're going north as opposed to eastbound through Willow Road. And then we also have a southbound route, which currently runs down Highway 1 to 166 Main Street and out to Highway 101. And it's been proposed to maybe have an alternate route where they continue on Highway 1 down to Clark Avenue and out to Highway 101 that direction. The original thought I looked at is, it would seem to me, just eyeballing it, that in terms of reducing emissions, if that's the goal of the alternate truck route going southbound, that it'd be more efficient to go out Willow to Highway 101 and south based on the number of stops and the indirect route through Orchid. But then that sort of exacerbates the problem with the amount of traffic going down Willow Road in that neighborhood. So there's kind of a trade-off there. But I do believe that you'd use less gas driving out Willow to 101 than you would trying to go through Guadalupe, out through Casmalia Road, and up through Orchid, because there's probably five or six stop signs or stop lights, and you're talking about city traffic as opposed to Willow Road, which has a single stop all the way to 101 and then freeway from there south.
Yes, and I'll look to our consultant in case I miss a step on this response. But with regards, I'll start with the north and the eastbound trips and the recommended measure to utilize the Willow Road now, considering the interchange has been constructed, and we've acknowledged that. The EIR did not identify a significant impact for the route through the existing and proposed northbound route, which goes Highway 1 to Halcyon and onto 101. There was a cumulative traffic impact associated with the increase. It's 0.78 peak hour trips, which they will address through that condition. And what the second half of the measure is a recommendation from planning, from the Public Works Department, to utilize that facility now that it's opened, and to avoid basically just the northern route, which is getting towards that more impacted level. And because it went in, the project as proposed was a Class 3 impact, the second part of that measure should be considered a recommendation, and that's why staff made the change to the language that you see before you today to say it is recommended. Second part of that response is, it's my understanding after having a follow-up meeting with both the applicant and Public Works last week, that sometime in the near future, most likely within the next year, the Willow Road route will become the official truck route. And depending upon how those other roads are then designated once that becomes the official truck route, this may become a requirement of the project to send the trucks on that route, as the northbound route as proposed would no longer be authorized for those types of trucks. So as written, the condition is a recommendation, that second part, and for purposes of the gentleman's agreement, we don't see a problem with them maintaining that. It has to do with sending trucks out before 6 a.m. Through that area. And the second half, the southbound route alternative, I believe, and this is where I'll make sure our consultants agree with my response, was that southbound route alternative was chosen not necessarily because of a major difference in vehicle miles traveled, but due to the path through, basically, the 166 path, which has a lot of traffic that goes through the community of Santa Maria. So I believe the reason was just to minimize the conflict, and that's why that was chosen, as opposed to a major difference between air quality emissions. But I'll just look to consultants, and they're shaking their head yes, that is the case.
Now, this is Greg Chittick with MRS. Yes, it was due to traffic issues and somewhat impacted intersections through the middle of Santa Maria, as opposed to air quality.
I think that's all I've got.
Okay. Thank you. Commissioner Christensen.
Yes, thank you. I got a couple of more of my questions answered through Tim's questions, but my main question left is the coastal plan policy regarding as policy 1A, the vote idea. If you could kind of go over a little bit more about what the intent of that policy is and the reasoning behind why it doesn't apply. I don't necessarily think it should apply, but the language is pretty clear for me, and I don't really get your explanation.
Well, since this explanation was provided to me with the help of County Council, I'm going to defer to County Council to provide the response to your question.
Written by a lawyer, hey.
he's got that lawyer.
Just the background behind Policy 1A, if you know anything about it.
So as far as I'm aware, Policy 1A, it arises out of an initiative measure that was passed by the voters in November of 1984. Mm-hmm. And it is essentially codified in our general plan policies, which is why it's in this section of the staff report. And so at the time that the measure was passed, it was an attempt to be able to require local regulation of offshore oil platforms. And the only way for the county to really have any part in that is if we somehow attached jurisdiction to the onshore facility. And so it's roughly, you know, an attempt to subject an onshore facility or an offshore facility to voter approval. And so given the nature of this particular project, we came up with this explanation of why we believed that there is a way to read it as not applying to this particular situation.
Yeah, I can understand. That makes more sense with that background. I didn't understand that background. And I actually was kind of surprised because because I thought, well, this must come from offshore oil concerns, and so I really wasn't sure how we got from concerns about offshore to this language, but now it makes sense to me. So thank you. That's all I had.
Commissioner Irving?
Murray, I'd like you to address a couple of questions regarding your Condition 18, the habitat restoration. And I see that you did in your revised conditions, you added the words on or off-site that the applicant was good with, but they had a different term, industrial something or other, industrial purposes, instead of where you're talking about coke storage. Do you have a strong feeling about this and why you wish to retain your wording or why didn't you agree with him?
Yes, with regards to the change that was made, staff believes that if either on or off-site, as long as the restoration occurs in the same habitat type, we're satisfied with that portion. So we've acknowledged their requested change. The other half of the requested change was to not require restoration if that area would be used for some other industrial use. At this time, we do not know what the industrial use is, and there is not an industrial use proposed with this project before you today. For those reasons, staff believes that Policy 3 under the ESHA policies applies to that habitat which was previously degraded and is required to be restored as a part of this project. We acknowledge that there may be future activities which could potentially utilize this space, which is why the condition was crafted to allow flexibility in where restoration would occur, other degraded habitats on or off-site in the same.
So if they wish to continue to use this for some other use other than coke storage, they can mitigate that by off-site restoration. Is that the short description of it? Or does that specific site, if they cease to store coke there, they have to start restoring that site, that particular site?
They have to restore an area equal to what they are no longer allowed to store coke within.
Okay.
And that area that they are allowed to store the coke within is required to be delineated in the field. So then you can go back and determine, here's the historical location.
Okay.
Here's where we're allowed. What's the difference, either in location, on or off-site?
Is this area that we're talking about here, is this within the secure boundaries of the facility?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And didn't we just go through something with the habitat restoration outside of the facility earlier this year? Wasn't there? What was that? Dunes restoration continuation or something of that sort. I forget now the specifics of it, but
I was not involved in that. I don't have direct knowledge of that project.
There's the cleanup site south.
It was the cleanup site.
Yeah, that's south of the river, about
So that's not immediately miles. Not immediately adjacent to
No, that's probably okay. 3 miles away.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Commissioner Murphy. This Coke storage, though, is within their secured perimeter.
That's correct.
Are there other areas within that area, within that perimeter, that have been or are being restored?
I'm not sure about within the perimeter, but I know the applicant has worked on portions of the project site in, west of the railroads in cooperation with both state parks and the Land Conservancy on restoration projects. But I don't know about within the secured perimeter of the facility.
Okay.
You could pass that question on to the applicant.
Where did the requirement for mitigation come from in the first place? Is this part of
policy 3?
Is this a mitigation from another permit or project
No.
or requirement? Where did it come from to start with?
So because we're in the coastal zone, we have our coastal zone ordinance, which has our standards for uses and standards for when you're doing development within sensitive habitat areas. We also have a document. It's called our Coastal Plan Policies document, which has policies, and some of those policies are to be implemented pursuant to programs established by the department, and some are to be implemented pursuant to the standards found within the ordinance. And that's what this one is. It references back to the standards for the environmental sensitive habitat areas and dictates the cleanup of that through the policies found in the coastal policies document and the ordinance combined. So it's what you look at the project and make sure that all the coastal policies have been met when they are applicable, and that's what we've identified in the coastal policies discussion of the staff report.
So because this kind of probably goes back to the applicant's question, it's the way I understand you're saying they've reduced the size of their coal or coke pile, and they're no longer using a portion of their property now to store coke on it. For that reason, it has to be restored, and it can't be used for some other industrial purpose.
As the condition is written, that area that previously has been utilized for coke storage can be used for another use. We don't know what that use is, so we're saying it needs to be restored pursuant to the policies in the coastal policies document. They have options. They could either restore in place in the exact location that was previously disturbed, or they can quantify that area and do the restoration either on within the facility secure area, outside the security area, or off-site. So we provided options for them.
Right. I understand the options, but I don't understand the requirement to restore in the first place. Why couldn't they park vehicles there or put some equipment there or use it as a storage yard? I'm not understanding why all of a sudden this industrial
We do not have a proposed use associated with the area that is no longer required as a part of this project. So for all intents and purposes...
Isn't it part of the previous project? Isn't it part of the existing facility, this space that was the coke pile?
That's correct. And it was previously degraded as part of those activities. Mm-hmm. So the policy 3 requires restoration of those degraded habitats, and that's what we're asking for. And we're trying to provide maximum flexibility in case there are other activities within that area that they would like to use that for.
Maybe
So if the project had specified, if part of the scope of the project was a reuse of that, then we wouldn't be having this conversation.
That is correct.
Maybe I could jump in here, because the way I read the applicant's letter on this issue is they were requesting a change to the timing of when the restoration condition would be triggered. And it's not so much that they must restore that
right.
specific site or that, you know, that portion of the coke pile. It's that at that time they would be required to mitigate for it and restore somewhere. And I believe that they were asking for that timing to be postponed until they were no longer using that area in general for any industrial purposes. Does that help?
Right. That's what they were saying. But my impression here is they're saying, no, you've got to restore that site and restore it within 10 years.
Unless they know what they're going to use it for. They're saying you got to start restoring it because you don't tell us what you're doing it, you're going to use it for.
Yeah, I guess I'm just somehow missing this whole concept here. I'm thinking of a project that has a footprint that's been there for 55 years, Now you're saying because you're not using this half acre over here anymore for sticking coal on it within that footprint, you're going to have to restore the habitat there. I think I'm missing something.
Commissioner Murphy, I guess the part of this is that because the requirement to look at restoring damaged habitats within ESHA is unique to the coastal zone. It's not something that's found in our inland policies. And so there's the combination. One is that this area is designated ESHA, environmentally sensitive habitat, and we do have that policy that says not only do you look at these certain parameters when you're evaluating a new project or a use when it's in ESHA, but you also have to look at areas of degraded habitat and restoring those habitat restoration as part of that project. And I think so that part we have to do, that is different from the inland areas, and that's part of our coastal policies implemented through the Coastal Zone Land Use Ordinance. And then in combination that, as part of this project, as I understand it, they're removing the use, the industrial use that has typically been in that area, and there is no
replacement.
There is no replacement industrial use that's going to happen there as part of this permit or the past permit. And so thus, looking at that policy, I think, you know, where we came up is that we're bound by that policy to look at restoration, because otherwise we're leaving a potentially damaged ESHA section.
And you're giving them 10 years to do the restoration work or to find a replacement use.
Where do you...
Right?
Yeah.
Isn't that correct?
Yeah.
I would agree with the first half of your comment. We're giving them 10 years to provide a replacement either on-site or off-site. And,
but they don't have 10 years to come up with a different use?
They could come up with a new use at any time, and when that project comes before us, we will evaluate that use on its own merits.
You mean that if they start parking trucks there, they have to get permission from you?
That's not a project, right?
That's a use.
Yeah, but
he's saying he doesn't know what the use is going to be.
We have not been informed of a use. If this project would have came in and the applicant would have said, as we remove and reduce the coke storage area, we are going to pave this and provide a parking area, then my answer to your question would be they have proposed an industrial use. The industrial use will continue in that area that was previously degraded, but we have not seen that. So we are evaluating this project on what has been proposed today.
That reduction of the coke storage area is not part of the project either.
Yeah,
it's not in the project, part of the project description per se.
No, it's a measure which is included in the mitigations for the project, and it's also part of an agreement between the applicant and the Air Pollution Control District, which I believe the agreement was initiated prior to this project being initiated.
I see Ms. Kopp is standing at the podium. Would you like to contribute to
Yes, it? I would. Thank you for your time. The project, as you have before you, is a 10% increase in throughput. Therefore, there might be a little bit more coke storage happening. We have an agreement with the Air District that we will only store that current production of coke in a specific area. This project doesn't address coke storage that's already on the facility, which is in a fenced area and is industrial use. So if we're looking just at this project, it says, yes, we will put that coke material within these delineated areas as per our Title V air permit. But we should still be able to use the coke storage as it is today in the current permit. And in our current permit with the county, it says, well, when we are no longer a facility, we will clean everything up. And we agree with that. But to have us reduce our footprint now, even though we have a use, an industrial use for that area, seems outside the scope of this project.
Well, that is a different interpretation of the ordinance. Ms. McDonald, what's your opinion of that interpretation?
I did not read the concern the same way, so I think you're right. It is a different type of an issue, because I think this deals with restoration of habitat as opposed to reduction in size of the coke pile, and so I'm not sure if that's the condition that creates more of an issue or the habitat restoration condition, and I think I will defer to staff, actually, on the ordinance itself.
Okay.
And I don't believe the applicant has an issue with the reduced storage area because they've already entered into an agreement with the Air District to reduce that storage area. So now it simply comes back to the policy and whether your commission believes the staff's interpretation of the language to restore it because they are no longer using it for that previous use, which degraded the area, to restore that either in location, on-site, or off-site. Staff's interpretation is that this policy applies and that area should be quantified in and restored in some location.
So the ordinance requires even a partial restoration and doesn't necessarily have to wait until the whole site is abandoned and remediated.
That's correct.
Okay. Commissioner Topping.
I'm just thinking about parallels here, and it's, I think there might be a parallel between the coastal ordinance language and state mining regulations where they extract a resource and then ultimately restore the site. I mean, it's a stretch, but the point is that the goal is to use the resource maximally and then ultimately transition the site back to a prior status and a prior condition for environmental purposes. So the question is, what's the trigger? Because many of these sites are very, very long-term uses. And what I hear the applicant saying is that as long as they have the opportunity to use this site for industrial purposes, they want to maximize that opportunity and that the trigger hasn't been met yet. And what I hear staff saying is that if there isn't any immediate intent for this, for the area, then the trigger should be that fact that there's not a specified use for it. I got this more or less right. The question is, when's the timing?
I believe you have kind of characterized it correctly. I think the two different interpretations is that by removal of coke from a portion of the storage area without an identified replacement use as part of this permit, staff's feeling is that policy is triggered and we have to look at least partial restoration. I think from the applicant's perspective, the fact that they're removing the coke doesn't remove the fact that it's still being used for a unspecified industrial use and thus wouldn't trigger that part, that policy that requires a restoration.
Thank you.
Well, here we go again. It seems like another fire kind of issue. Any ideas from commissioners? Do you want to do a straw vote on this, or how do you all feel about it? I'm not sure I have the sense of the commission on this one.
Well, if I understood the applicant, what she said is that this coke limitation, the areas only applies to the new coke, and the old coke can still be in or the other area can still be used for coke storage. Is that possible? And then in our condition 12, it actually refers to storing coke outside the coke storage area as long as you use a lined area or other equivalent measure to prevent groundwater contamination. So it contemplates storage of coke outside of this area.
So I'm a little
confused here.
A little bit of history as I was speaking across the table. Obviously, as you could see from the aerial photos, there has historically.
Can we see a photo? That's another good. Are we talking about a half acre or 5 acres? I'm unclear. What's this sensitive area you're talking about restoring? How many acres or square feet is it ballpark wise?
Well, I can pull out my measuring tool here in just a moment.
I think that's what I'll remember most about this hearing.
So here's the coke storage area. As previously, it was a very large area, and I'm going to have to flip over to here to throw some measurements up. But Give me just a moment. Where's area?
Is there any way to enlarge this aerial?
Just turn around.
Sorry. It's the square.
All right, point.
Yeah, kind of hard on the neck. But
oh, my God. I give it.
Yeah. Polygon. All right.
I'll just stare at this.
Yeah, perfect. And if the applicant sees me going beyond the historic limits of storage, please let me know.
This is the true test to see how good Murray is.
Boy.
So with that rudimentary measurement, that blue area, and I'll look over to the applicant to see if that approximately represents the historic area of storage. I got a nod yes. That is measuring out at 27 acres.
I can provide a little bit. This is Erin Arlen-Janae. We have entered into a coke and sulfur storage and handling plan with Phillips 66. We have a final version that I have before me, May 2011. And just to give you a reference of the size and what they have agreed to at this point, back in December 1 of 2009, the surveyed volume of the on-site coke storage was 4,899,349 cubic feet, which was surveyed, so close, a little less than what Murray was captured here. And the quantity that is in our plan is on-site, and it didn't matter if it was from the 10% increase or the existing operations, shall be less than 3,499,349 cubic feet.
Yeah, well, that's fine. Addresses cubic feet, but it doesn't address area. So this is the original. What's this?
That blue polygon on the screen there represents the approximate area of historic coke storage.
And is there an identified area, known area for remediation that's contemplated for this condition here? Is that known now, or is that
I don't know if the area measurement is known. It sounds like a cubic yardage is known, and then what's required by the conditions is that they physically delineate that area, which allows them to store that amount in the field. So that's where our basis would come from.
Well, if it's done by tonnage or cubic feet or whatever, they could, depending how tall the stack is, it could cover all 27 acres, or it could cover 20 acres or 5 acres.
Without the limitation in place through the agreement with the Air Pollution Control District, but that agreement, separate from this project, prior to this project, is limiting the storage and likely the area in which they store it. I don't know if there's a square footage limitation or not.
The memorandum of agreement that we entered in with the Air District is to delineate via GPS of where the current production of coke is going to be stored. They did not address that we need to start removing coke storage in other areas. So it's a much smaller footprint of the currently produced coke. Historically, we've got more coke stored there, and as the market changes and the conditions change, we can get that coke and move it out. But it is all within our fenced area, as you can see by the property line, and we would just like to be able to clean it up at our timetable and still use that area for industrial purposes.
So for the record, that was Ms. Kopp speaking for the applicant.
I'm probably done talking. I don't. I'm still obviously confused.
I can understand the applicant wanting to. They have this big area that's going to basically start to become barer as the coke leaves, and then they would like to be able to use it for something. But what are they going to use 27 acres of coke contaminated land for? I mean, if you want to build a parking lot, yeah, but they're not going to build a 27-acre parking lot. So to me, I'm kind of leaning towards staff's interpretation in the sense that if, kind of going back to the mine analogy, if there was a mine and there was work being done on it, and you kind of knew, okay, well, this area is now not really being mined anymore, you'd kind of want that to start being remediated rather than waiting for many years, you know, many more years. So, again, I can't see why staff is saying, hey, without a use actually designated, you know, it's hard to think of something that would use so much land and to have it sit there for such a long time.
I don't remember the numbers. Was 4-point-something million versus going down to 3-point-some million, so it's about a
quarter. Well, they're not saying they have to do it right away.
No, I'm just saying the reduction is about a quarter of the area, so maybe we're talking about 5 acres. I don't know. I'm just thinking of any property you own. No. If you're failing to use the property, triggers are required to do a restoration.
If you're never going to use the property again,
yeah,
you know, that's kind of what I'm hearing.
I guess because it's in Esha, I guess there is this.
Yeah.
The Esha issue is what's triggering all this, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
And
it says you can't.
If I understand, let me put it in my simple terms, if I can. If what this is requiring is if they stop using a portion of it, they can't use it for anything else. But until they've quantified how much area they're not using, and then they could take that quantified area and go off-site and do restoration there, and then continue to use the whole area. Am I oversimplifying this?
I think I missed the first part of your comment.
So what we've got is they got this 27-acre area that they've used historically for coke storage. If they stop using a portion of that area for coke storage, you want it that area that is not being used anymore. You want that quantified.
Correct.
And then that amount of land that's no longer being used, they need to do habitat restoration either on-site or off-site. So they could continue if they say, well, we're not using this one-acre area anymore. They can go off-site, do restoration off-site of 1 acre, and continue to use that 1 acre that is on-site for some other use.
That's my interpretation, and the only thing I would say is if that use was something that triggered the definition of development, and then
agreed. Saying okay.
So yes, I agree with that interpretation.
Okay, I can live with this then.
Yeah, and that's part of the benefit to the county for approving the project with this. It reduces the scope of the.
Yeah, but there's not. We're not saying you can't use it completely. We're just saying identify it, go elsewhere.
Okay, that's my understanding.
I'm good with it now.
Okay. All right, so I guess the language then would stay the same. And who brought that up? I've lost track of who is questioning. Okay, Commissioner Christensen, are you finished with your questions? Commissioner Irving, you're finished? Commissioner Murphy? And what about Commissioner Topping?
Just one real quick question back on the Willow Road. I want to make sure I got it clear. Why are we recommending it? Rather than just asking them to do it directly, the interchange is already completed, right?
That's correct.
So that's out. That part's out.
Actually, what would help if you could? You did this at the beginning of our hearing on this. Could you reread the change language to 16 or show it?
Yeah, we just got it up on your screen. So prior to the hearing, we changed what is shown in red from in addition to it is recommended. And to answer your question, Mr. Topping, the reason for that change that you see in red halfway down is because we determined that the level of impact as a result of the project was less than significant. So
small.
This is simply should be considered a recommendation from the Public Works Department. So we changed that language to reflect that it was a Class 3 going in and a Class 3 coming out.
All right. Thank you,
Murray. Could you scroll the downward in your new conditions of approval there? I just wanted to make sure that you did add the words verification with Cal Fire or County Fire.
And the $10,000.
And the 58.
$25,000.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. I want to bring up one item that actually was a letter that commissioners received and presumably staff did from J.H. Edwards Company, Jeff Edwards. And this does have to do with the coastal access topic that we had discussed earlier. And I think a lot of the letter we've already addressed, but there was one in the last paragraph. I suggest the offer of dedication be made a condition of the permit issuance and include an 80-foot swath coterminous with the existing maintenance road. The 80 foot, does that ring any bells as far as what is the width that staff is contemplating the access to be going forward?
Well, as you
40 or what is it?
Recall the condition refers back to the ordinance section, and with regards to that section of the ordinance and vertical access, which is what we're looking for on this project, right. Within rural areas of the county, the minimum width for vertical access is 10 feet. So as the condition is written, the applicant would be required to offer a minimum of 10 feet at this time. Through the subsequent analysis, it could be determined that a higher intensity use, such as the things that have been discussed today, additional vehicular access, may be appropriate. That determination has not been made to date. Mm-hmm. So if your commission wants to discuss dictating what the width of that would be, we can do so, or we can simply follow the procedures that are outlined in the ordinance, mm-hmm. get the dedication today, which would likely be the minimum required by ordinance, and yeah. move forward through that process.
Well, I suspect that Mr. Edwards made this recommendation based on his sense that a wider access might be beneficial to the county to have at this particular location, and I wondered if staff had thought about or could tell the commission of possible benefits for a wider access. And since we have the applicant here, if the applicant off the top might see any issues with that, so that maybe we could have a little more direction anyway and not leave it to the minimum of 10, which doesn't seem very wide to me. So I'd just like to see what staff might have thought about on this point.
Just one comment on the letter. It appears this is taken out of an alternative access study prepared in 2006.
Oh, that's,
he's referring to a figure in that study that looked at alternative access to the dune, and this was one of the possible accesses, and apparently there's a figure that showed an 80-foot easement from Highway 1 to the dunes through Phillips, I assume.
And the way staff expects this to play out would be that through the analysis as required by the coastal access section of the ordinance, the suitability, which we discussed earlier, of compatible and adjacent uses, and specifically the discussion of where that access would let out to state parks, very important person in those discussions as to whether or not vehicular access to that point at the property line would be appropriate. That needs to be part of the discussion that occurs through that subsequent permit process. So to answer your question, staff doesn't have a recommendation for your commission to move forward in any other way than to meet the ordinance requirements, because at this time it's a little bit early to say with any certainty that it's appropriate for the site without doing that follow-up work.
Well, I suspect that would be the case. We just don't have enough evidence one way or the other to make intelligent determinations, and I am hopeful that the applicant would participate in good faith in those discussions and keep the broader interests of the county in mind during those conversations, and I'm hopeful that the applicant will do that. Okay, I did, because Mr. Edwards submitted this, I did want to make sure that this hearing considered the points he's making. So those are all of my questions, and I think all the other commissioners have indicated that.
So if I could jump in one more time here. Staff has provided some additional language regarding the safety finding, which we discussed in the portion of the deliberations that had to do with the fire-related issues. And sorry for scrolling through this on your screen. But here is the additional language that we have provided, and it basically reflects the information contained in the EIR as well as the safety issues raised by the fire department here today and the condition that was applied to the project. So it provides further support for that finding that your commission will be making.
What page are the findings on again? 17, I start. Just wanted to ask Ms. McDonald, I know we've added some conditions here today. Does that affect the findings in any way? You know, this business about the fire, we've added two conditions for the fire. For example, it shouldn't affect any of the findings, should it?
I think the only potential impact the changes could have would be on the CEQA findings if we did anything to the mitigation measures, but I don't think we did. And we usually include findings in this that address, you know, possible changes. And
okay.
The idea that the changes don't require additional environmental review, which in this case I don't think we even touched the mitigation measures.
No, I don't think so. And the new conditions, fire conditions, weren't required for mitigation measures, correct?
Correct.
Yeah, so wouldn't affect that. Okay, just thought I'd better ask the question. Okay, Commissioner from the district, Mr. Murphy, would you care to get the motion ball rolling?
All right. I will move to certify the final environmental impact report in accordance with applicable provisions of the California Environmental Quality Act, Public Resources Code Section 21000XX, also to approve the conditional use permit based on findings as listed in Exhibit A as amended and conditions listed in Exhibit B as amended, adoption of CEQA findings in Exhibit C.
Second.
Second on that.
And real quickly, I just realized that the recommendation that Mr. Murphy read for referenced a conditional use permit. So this should be a development plan and coastal development permit. My apologies for that incorrect reference.
I will amend my motion to refer to a development plan, a coastal development permit, instead of a coastal or a conditional use permit.
And can I have a resecond on that?
Absolutely.
All right.
And I assume nothing we did required any change in Exhibit C, CEQA findings?
No, we're comfortable with the findings in Exhibit C.
Okay. Any discussion before the roll call? Hearing none, Ramona, please call the roll.
Commissioner Murphy?
Yes.
Commissioner Irving?
Yes.
Commissioner Christensen?
Yes.
Commissioner Topping?
Yes.
Chairman O'Grady?
Yes, motion passes 5-0. Congratulations to the applicant, and thank you very much to staff for a fine report. Since this is my final Planning Commission meeting, I'd just like to take a few moments to make some acknowledgments. I would like to thank staff for the professionalism that they have exhibited through my entire 3 years on this commission. I think that speaks highly not only of your skills as individuals at the work you do, but also to the high quality of the training and management that we have here at our county. I think we're very fortunate to have the high caliber of staff that we do. I'd like to thank in particular Ramona Hedges, who, as our commission secretary, has really done an excellent job at facilitating the commission's work. So thank you.
You're welcome.
Another enjoyable part of being a commissioner is working closely together with your fellow commissioners. And I have been fortunate. I get a little emotional at times like these, I'm sorry. But I've been I've been very fortunate to and privileged to have had such support and cooperation from my fellow commissioners, and I'm going to miss you all a lot. And Commissioner Irving, if we follow tradition, you will follow in my footsteps as chair. And I wish you well. Staff was kind enough to have a little coffee and cake for me after the lunch hour, and they presented me with this engraved gavel, and I'm very appreciative of that thoughtfulness. A lot of nice things were said to me there, and you know, I don't want to leave. I think I want to stay. In fact, I might even give Debbie Arnold a call and see if they say that she hasn't appointed anybody yet. So I wish Debbie and my successor for the 5th District all the best. And I also want to acknowledge Supervisor Jim Patterson, who gave me this opportunity to serve, to be of service in my community as a planning commissioner. So I really have appreciated that. And before I get to use this gavel, we have final business to take care of, and that is I need to take a motion for all testimony and documents into the record.
So moved.
And a second, please.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None. Motion passes 5-0. And then I need a motion to adjourn the meeting.
I think before we adjourn,
what's that?
A few of us, at least I'd like to say
something. I'm sorry.
I have an objection.
Order.
I just wanted to thank Commissioner O'Grady for his service, certainly to the community, but have really enjoyed being on the Planning Commission, and your leadership this year as chairman was excellent, and your attention to detail and a methodical approach to and the fairness. I mean, I've got to say you seem to be fair on every project. I don't typically see any prejudice, so to speak, coming in. You limit way the projects on their merits and rule on them accordingly, and I appreciate that. And
Thank you.
I've enjoyed getting to know you. Hopefully we'll see you back here once in a while.
Likewise.
We've had a lot of lunches together, so I'd hope in the future maybe at least you'll come down and give us hell at lunch about what's going on.
Well, you might see me at one of those.
You might see you at the podium. Yeah, maybe I'll have the gavel. I can gavel you down.
I'll probably deserve it, too.
You've certainly, it's been a real pleasure and an honor to serve with you. You've done a great job, in my mind, and I've been here for 3 years. Three of us came on at the same time, and fortunately, you and Carlin took us under your wings a little bit, and because we were extremely busy, as you know, from the get-go, and it's been a learning experience on the job, but I think we've got a great group of people here, and you contributed a lot to that, so thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Tim. I appreciate that.
Can I say something?
Yes.
I
really don't want to leave.
Sometimes my family accuses me of not being a good listener, and I think for good reason, but I have to say that I think your service has been exemplary in this regard, willingness to listen to everybody and all different perspectives, and I think you set a very nice precedent.
Well, thank you. Appreciate that, Kent. It's a pleasure working with you.
And that's coming from the former director of planning for this county or city of Los Angeles.
City
of Los Angeles.
Yeah, I'll echo those comments and then say I'm going to really miss your attention to detail. And I expect to send you staff reports to say, please check into this for me. Thank you very much for your service.
Well, I do need a doorstop or two.
Yeah, I'll ditto that part. And thank you again.
Well, thank you all. You've made this a memorable last day, and I really appreciate it. So I just want to thank everybody and the public for being so courteous, respectful, and I've really been proud of our community when they get up to the podium. Even if they disagree with what's happening, they've been very thoughtful and respectful in expressing and articulate in expressing their points of view, and I think that speaks a lot for our San Luis Obispo County community. So with that, I'd like a motion to adjourn the meeting, and the next meeting will be in the new year on January 10th.
So moved.
A second, please.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? None. Motion passes 5-0. Thanks, everybody, and happy holidays. Thank you.